Hey, this is Cap, and you're watching Thorin, the only man besides Richard Lewis who somehow found a way to get both League of Legends and Dota Redditors to hate him.
Right, it's going to be another one of my donator discussions for all the people who are swagged out on Patreon. For this one, we've actually got two new people who are joining the group. As people know, we operate the Fight Club rules here, so the new people have to come with a topic and start things out. It's just obviously to break the ice and get people going and all that jazz. So two of the people we've got here, by the way, first of all, one thing I'm never certain about is, technically, and this is a little pro tip for people out there, the name that's going to show up for me, that you're a patron of mine, is whatever you signed up with as the account on Patreon. So spoiler, if you want me to say a different name, like you don't want me, for example, to say your real life name, either change your name there, message me in a DM and I'll change it on the like list. Or in this particular case, I won't say your names, but you guys potentially could tell me. So if the one of you in the top left corner could, with the picture on Zoom, could say what name you want us to call you by.
Oh, that's me then. Okay, cool. Yeah, you can just call me Paul.
Right, okay. So what games do you follow, Paul?
So I mostly follow League of Legends. I've watched a lot of CSGO, but I've played a ton of League of Legends, watched League of Legends since before the LCS, all that kind of stuff. So,
right, and who is the other person in the call?
You can just call me Andy, and I follow Counter-Strike.
All right, there we go. And then the last person is Eddie, and he follows both League of Legends and Counter-Strike, but crucially, he's just watching Counter-Strike, he's not playing it. I mean, I will say on that last detail, like, I actually think of all the games in the world, I don't think you even need to play Counter-Strike to enjoy it. It's very much is just like a sport in that sense. I don't think you're even missing anything by not having played it, mate. Like, don't let anyone who just plays it and is like matchmaking fucking like one of the AK ranks be like, oh, you know nothing about the game. Like, they know nothing about the game as well. Spoiler, like they aren't doing anything in those matchmaking games. So, okay. Right, how about this then? Paul, you start us off here, mate. What's like a topic that you're interested in? Can be anywhere, obviously, is just to start.
Yeah. So as far as League of Legends, the one thing that I really wanted to talk about is the concept of the eye test and results-based analysis. I think usually when people talk about results-based analysis in like gaming or in general, what they're saying is like, okay, this team won, so retroactively we now know that the things they did were good. And I think that
that they're better also goes along, you know, as a correlation, yeah.
Yeah, and I think usually when people say that, what they're trying to say is that is a product of statistics and not a product of the eye test, right? That it's the statistics that kind of tell you after the fact what happened. But I think a big problem I have with League of Legends analysis is that unless you are very, very good at the game, like let's say pro level or at a minimum, I don't know, like Masters Plus or something like that, essentially your eye test is just results-based analysis because you see a Nautilus hook get landed and you're like, well, that was a good play. But you don't know that based on positioning, that player had opened themselves to be hooked like 7 times because it just so happened to not occur. And I think that one of the things I keep seeing when it comes to like all pro voting and things like that is that people are just like, okay, well, obviously the team that won is best, but then they try and use the eye test as a justification for like, well, that's why that actually was correct. And in particular, kind of what I'm talking about here is like the whole like JoJo pun thing, or JoJo Kyun, however you say his name.
Okay.
Because in my mind, like I watched every single game of LCS this season. I think it is absolutely baffling for someone to not think that either Bjergsen or Abadage was by far the best mid laner in the LCS this year. I think that whether you look at that from an eye test perspective, a statistics perspective, or just, you know, whatever, a combination of the two, they are just so far ahead in kind of every respect. And so I can break that down more, but I'm kind of, I don't know if that's like,
I mean, to tie it back in, because the problem with that is like you essentially didn't tether that to your original point. So the premise is it's just because EG has been the better team overall and won more games that people would automatically infer the opposite scenario that obviously JoJo must be the best and he must be better than Bjergsen and Abadage, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they kind of, I guess what I'm trying to really say is that, yes, that, but partially because since people think they have these amazing eye tests at the like at analyst level, that they can kind of use that to retroactively justify their eye tests in the same way someone might do with statistics.
Like, I sort of see what you mean, but like, what's the alternative?
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that the only real alternative is having more.
Like, here's what I'm confused by, basically. You actually set up what is normally what people say. So essentially, results-based analysis is actually used as a derogatory term. It just means you just think whoever won did it right and always was going to win. That's sort of how it's inferred from like an LS or something. What I don't understand, like you haven't explicated for me the part where it's like when you say that that's all you can do, because it seems like there's a distinction there. Like you were starting to do it with the example of the Nautilus example. So what you were essentially saying there, if someone doesn't follow the game that closely, is if you land a hook, basically, you're going to think, oh, what a great job. But maybe actually, like he missed, as he said, like six other better opportunities for a hook early. And so it's like, actually, of the seven, that was the worst. Just because it's the only one that's landed, you might think, wow, like, he's an amazing Nautilus player, right? I'm confused as to that's...
So I think what's
the scenario there?
Yeah, so I guess what I'm trying to say is that... For many of the analysts, let's say like on the LEC or on the LCS desk or whatever, right? The vast majority of those people are not high ELO players or former pros or like recent coaches, right? Now, obviously, you could talk about like a Mark Z who was a coach, but he was a coach, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years ago and not of a particularly successful team. But what I'm trying to say is because most of those analysts do not actually have high level like gaming like skills in the game, whether that is matchups or like laning phase positioning, things like that, unlike someone like say like a Cadral or even like a Dom, for example, their eye test is just results-based analysis because they're not actually seeing literally in the moment what good or bad things are happening. They are only able to judge something as good based on if it resulted in a kill or in a tower.
Nah, I see what you mean. Okay. First of all, one thing I would say is I think you would actually be shocked by how few pros could do that. As in, just because they have the information in their brain doesn't mean they could explain it to you or even model what they're talking about. Like, I actually think one of the worst things about pros is I don't think the part of your brain that you play with is the part they use to talk. So I think as a result, there are some genius pros that seem like idiots when they talk and actually might sound like they don't understand the game at all. But then you look at them in the game and they're a wizard. They know everything. So first of all, I think actually you would be shocked even if... Like, I put it this way. I'll give you an obvious example. If we took Caps and we had him... Like, obviously, he'd have to learn how to commentate and stuff, so he's not total shit in that sense. But say he understood the basics of commentary, I would bet you he could not, in lifetime, actually break down very much of what's going on. It's the reason why, if you've ever noticed, like, you might have seen on core streams, people like Febavan, when they were still active players, would come on and join Dom. And do they actually break the game down? Do they? Bullshit. They just sit and watch it, like, on a Sunday, if we were watching the Premier League, like, oh, great goal. I thought he was going to do better. Like, they're all just talking like a fan, like we all do. Like, I think, first of all, you have to engage a different part of your brain to actually analyse that. It's actually why, essentially, what I'm telling you is, believe it or not, some of the people on camera are actually incredibly good at this. It's just that it's a very limited format. And, spoiler, you aren't on camera. You're sat at home judging them. And you can even go back and think of what they said. You can pause the VOD, you go review. There's a million angles that essentially like people at home get an unfair advantage. And then the other thing I'd also say, this is the part I found a bit weird, because what's weird is what you're seeing, even though it's true, LS does actually try to play the game quite a lot to find out like certain mechanical elements. Based on what you're saying, here's my question back to you. By that logic, do you think LS is using results-based analysis? Because he was never a pro, obviously.
Well, and so that's why I wouldn't just limit it to being a pro. Like, LS for sure has gotten masters on, like, numerous occasions, right? He's been, like, a high elo player.
I mean, that's irrelevant to, like, if he's talking about, like, Faker versus Chovy, though.
I suppose that's true, but I guess I mean in the sense of, like, laning stuff, right? Like, when it comes to, like, positioning or matchups. Like, I think a lot of those things, whether you're Faker or you're Chovy, still kind of apply, right, in terms of, like, you know, if there's that famous thing from like Apta where he talked about like in a specific matchup, like you're just not supposed to hit the wave at all, because if you do, then it won't push in on wave three, and on wave three, you're going to die to this one, right? I think that kind of stuff you can't know unless you are a very high level player, whether that's in solo queue or as obviously a former professional.
All right, I think I've got a grasp on this. Here's the thing, mate. I'll just do this answer, then you can jump in, mate. Basically, there's two quick things I would say. One is this. I would say you're way too deep in the weeds right now, mate. Like, I don't really know why that would be an issue, that someone doesn't know like a hook or like a specific, like on this wave. Like, that's not really what determines a game of League of Legends. Like, yeah, if you add up 1,000 of those, probably does. But like, to give you an example from my native Counter-Strike, you might have heard this line before. This is a great line I have. I always say what makes Counter-Strike a very compelling and almost brilliant game is that if you ever actually play it yourself, you'll think it's totally random. You'll think, well, it was just that the flash went off 1 second before I came in, so I wasn't blind. Or I was blind this time, so I couldn't see him. This time I go around the corner and the guy's behind the box. He kills me. Next time I go by, I don't check the box, but he's not there and I get through. You think, fuck, it's just luck, right? And yet, despite all those small instances where there can be all these branches of luck, as a general trend, even individual maps play out with patterns you can see, and the better team generally does make the better decisions. The better player does win out the scenarios. And in general, those like smaller moments of variance don't actually seem to contribute that much to the overall narrative. Like the overall aspect, you don't really have to have been an expert pro to sort of know. I mean, the analogy would be, you might not know the mechanics of what Forrest is doing, but you might understand if you were to use, say, a chess model, that if Forrest is your queen, then he's a really powerful piece that moved through this area and brushed aside a bunch of pawns, if that was the analogy, you know. So like, I would say that's more, in my opinion, what you're trying to do when you analyze. Like, for me, I actually think people get way too often in the weeds when they try to make it about mechanics or like raw, like only tactical strategy in Counter-Strike, no, like just dynamics or team modeling of what role you play and stuff. Like, in my opinion, the reason why someone like LS, I think, is way ahead, both in thinking and talking of even, put it this way, I'll tell you straight up, I think he's ahead of any of the Western pros. Caps, Perks, you run up the list, mate. Mithy, Soaz, all the GOATs, he's better than all of them. And here's why. Because they spent so much of their fucking life just practicing what you're talking about. Shit little mechanics in lane. What when you land a hook, how you do a flash. He spent the same amount of time watching their games. And he's watched so many games that the joke is, even if he himself doesn't know how every role feels, just think of the raw data in his brain of seeing the best players do those moves. Though, because there's the angle I feel like you were missing in the first part. Maybe you didn't explain it this way. Is, yeah, I have never played, for example, like Malzahar versus Orianna mid. I'm not a mid laner, right? But I tell you what, mate, I've seen quite a few games of it. I've probably seen more games of it than a lot of people have played, if you know what I mean. So in a different way, I have a different bank. Now, I would never access that and claim like I'm an expert specifically, but I have trends in my mind. I have things that are set up. And obviously, you can see in that analogy, it doesn't have to be based on who won or who got the kill. You know, over time, like if I watch enough, surely the game will teach me what happens in certain settings. Is that off base for that?
I think that's a great point, right? And obviously, I think there are different kinds of knowledge. I guess my thing kind of was like tying it specifically into like the JoJo Pukyun, like, you know, all pro thing.
But this way, I can give you that one. I'll give you like a 1 minute rant on that one. That one does piss me off because essentially that's like a hard con. Like, you're almost never going to get that. Like, the only comparison I could give you to that, if you know the old LCS, would maybe be when like who he was in CLG and they won the LCS and they went to the MSI final. But even then, I don't think anyone actually said he was the best mid laner. But imagine they had, okay, because they won and they went to the MSI final. Essentially, that's actually a bigger problem than esports, mate. That is just sports analysis in general. Like, first of all, I noticed in sports and esports, people, because everyone's whole career narrative is about winning the big one, that's like the religion, that's like the state religion of sport. And so what you'll find is even people who, if you actually ask them to break down like quarterbacks in the NFL or football players or something, even if you ask them to break down the skills, they would acknowledge this guy who never won might have been the best in an area. Their brain cannot allow them to think that the person who won wasn't the best. Because it's essentially, there's almost like a teleology attached to that. It's mythical. The logic is you only win when you are worthy, when you have attained the goal, when you have done everything. So, and then obviously, you know, sports people, they tie in all those narratives of the guy who works the hardest and he wants it the most and all this shit that has nothing to do with the game. So what I would say is, first of all, you're already going to get mired whenever you're talking. In fact, that's actually, by the way, why I think pros suck in esports for that reason. Like someone like Cadrell has to believe Caps is the best all the time because Caps always wins. He could never believe that for a moment Vethio was better. Because how could he be? He doesn't win. That's on some fucked up level. Even though Cadrell, by the way, again, if I just get him to look at a VOD of Vethio, he could tell me everything. He could tell me way more than I can, by the way. But that's an area where he analytically might not be able to model. He might get trapped in a little bit of a loop from when he was a pro. And then I would say the other analogy would be this. I definitely agree with the bigger principle, like about like the fact that it's hard to judge, especially based on the result, what happens. Because one of the most frustrating experiences of my time following sports is when I got into the NFL. Because I obviously, from the outside, you watch the NFL and you think this is so complicated, there's all these strats, like you have to know all the positions. So I'm thinking, right, I'm just such a noob, I'm never going to have a grasp on it like all these experts. And I'm not joking, I think within a year of watching the NFL, I had found like half a dozen like modeling problems that just cripple the entire game and make it actually shit if you want to know high level NFL stuff. So basically, without knowing the sport, essentially the principle you'll all understand is there's offense and defense in the NFL, and people don't play for both teams. The people who are the offensive players are only on the offense, and the people who are on the defense are only on the defense. So spoiler, that means the quarterback doesn't play defense. Well, if you ever look up the great dynasties in NFL history, they all won because they had top 10 ranked defenses, basically. Almost every single one of them. Now, what that actually means is when you're talking about the quarterback, the lead offensive player, you should always be shading into what you say about how he played, his expectations. Two factors. One, how good was his defense? Because that's going to make it harder for him to win the game. And more importantly, how good is the opponent's defense? Instead, they don't do any of that. They pretend the NFL is basketball and even a 1v1 game, and it's just quarterback against quarterback. Well, the analogy I often give on my Discord is, imagine we are two archers and we're in an archery competition. But the problem is, my arrow is twice as big as yours and my target is twice as close as yours. But we both fire the arrow. I get the bullseye. You get the one ring outside the bullseye and everyone tells me I'm the winner and I'm better than you. And in fact, you should try and be as good as me. That's the NFL. So if you see the analogy, that is also just esports. Like, I purposely made it in sports because I'm sort of telling you, it's, aside from people like me, LS, and a few weird people, maybe Monty, there's not that many people are trying to even, I think, explore this space. I think actually in sports in general, it's just taken for granted that results, I mean, there is only results-based analysis, right? You'll even see people say stupid, like, I'll give you an example, mate. If you watch the UFC, I could not believe the way that that fucking last title fight was analysed. It was analysed as though the person winning the fight 90% of the fight utterly fucked up everything and was inferior and will never be the best again. And the guy who won with a fluke knockout, they acted like that was always going to come, and he was like some genius who was waiting. Like, they made it into a movie, mate. Like, it wasn't real life. I was thinking, where are the experts? And these are the experts. That's the key thing. These are like champion fighters talking. These are people who've watched every UFC fight for 20 years. By the way, who else wanted to jump in on the point? Yeah, go on.
I was going to piggyback off that too. It's like, you have to think to some degree, who are they appealing to? It's like, is there, what is the percentage of people that are wanting that high, deep, detailed
analysis? Yes, exactly.
Versus the pleb who's like, yo, my buddy threw 20 game or 20 bucks on this game. I'm going to watch this and just cheer on whoever the fuck, you know, he's, you know, bought into. So,
oh, you're definitely right. A lot of it is just water cooler fodder, isn't it? Yeah. They just want to give you a few easy topics to discuss. Yeah,
exactly. So it's like, I think they should be delivering to that because they have the capabilities to, but at the end of the day, they're also, they like fucking Team Liquid's Team Liquid Honda now. It's like, they have so much money in this. You have to appeal to the people who just turn it on. Like, what's LCS? Oh, okay. Like, you know, so they can get interested and join in. So
sure.
I think to some degree, it's a balance of trying to find that niche of the people who are dedicated and die hard and want to participate in that kind of discussion versus the people who play ARAMs and are like, oh, I enjoy watching TSM or I enjoy watching Team Liquid, yada, yada, you know?
Yeah, one point you're making actually that is also a valid thing you have to mention is that obviously it is also about like the idea that if you're too much out of the purview of the normal person, they probably won't want you on a broadcast because that is by definition in theory, it's not for me, but for other people it is about like giving the people what they want. And I would say like a lot of fans essentially, I don't think they would mentally be able to handle it if like someone won the Super Bowl and then I came on and was like, he's not really even the better quarterback in the game though, was he? Like, you know, the other guy actually was better, but the defense, and that would sort of like crush the appeal of the sport to some people, you know, wouldn't to me, but again, I acknowledge I'm an extreme individual though.
Yeah, for sure. Paul,
but if I can,
go on, jump in, mate.
If I can jump in, like, let's all remember that we're all the nerds. Like, we're the ones that want all the, like we're just nerdy as hell on this stuff. And Duncan, I want to throw this to you with what you were sort of hinting at there. I had a question, which was something like, do you think the fact that you banter really well on camera and you're an interesting personality on camera, do you think that you would have had the longevity of your career? Do you think you would have hit the big, you know, sort of milestones you've hit with some of the tournaments you've been to and the majors and all that sort of stuff, if you didn't have that element of your personality, if you were more analytical and dry and all that sort of stuff?
No, almost certainly not. Because I mean, if people don't know, I actually only basically, here's the thing, in real life, I only became someone, what's funny about my method is, I've often explained this, I actually became the things I am in real life as a charismatic person directly through trying to improve at interviews and talk shows. Things like learning how to talk without a script, not getting worried if you sort of get thrown for a moment, doing things like studying loads and then telling yourself you don't have to use any of that in this. So you feel total freedom as to whether to go in depth on something, to tease something, to make it open-ended. A lot of those things I worked on. I actually did it just for my job reasons. I was trying to get better in that sense, but it just inadvertently leveled me up in a bunch of other ways. So I would say, first of all, that is actually the whole reason why, you know, sometimes you have that really weird thing happen on like Twitter or Reddit where there'll be someone who'll come along and they'll be like, I was around in the early days of CS and I've never heard of Thorin. Right. First of all, that is absurd. I had loads of articles. I was on all the main websites. I worked for all the big things. So that's total nonsense. Half the time they are a hater. But the other half of the time, what they mean is they don't remember me. Because back then, if I did an article, except for like 1 year where I did try a bit of like experimental column writing in sort of a Hunter S. Thompson fashion, aside from that, everything I did was dry and analytical, mate. It was just like, if I was doing like top 10 players, it was just like a professional presentation. You know, this guy had the most championships, or this one had the better career, or this guy was better this year. I'd present it all. And in fact, if anything, back then, I used to intentionally not put any of myself in, because I really did have that. I mean, I was in a totally different paradigm of life itself. I really did think there was like objective reality and there's a basis to all this. And like, you should have like a... You should, the idea that objectivity means to not include any of your own opinions, and you should just present things as they are. Again, a lot of like sort of naive ideals, you know. So I would say I definitely changed a lot since then. But the key thing is, a lot of people don't know this. At the end of 1.6, I actually did do a whole bunch of commentary. I commentated some of the majors for ESL, if people don't know. I was actually just a stand-in, but I just did such a good job. They kept hiring me for like two or three tournaments. And what happened was, I was the color commentator to Joe Miller's play-by-play. And at the time, if people don't know, Joe Miller was probably like one of the biggest and best play-by-play casters in the world. So when I did that, what I noticed was, at the beginning, like every person who ever casts, you'll notice, if they don't hate you, initially people are just like generally warm towards you. Oh, it's a new person. This is interesting. So I'd say for the first 6 months, people liked it. But then this is what's hilarious. Because I was the nerd who used to sit on Skype at home with Lurpis when he wasn't at the tournament, and we'd all go like, oh, these commentators fucking suck. They never talk about the economy. They never talk about the rounds. They don't understand what was happening in the clutch. I wanted to be the guy who did exactly what I wanted at home. And so I did incredibly dry analysis. It was like, for example, I'll give you a punchline example of what I'm talking about. There was once a round where a team was playing on DOS 2 in Counter-Strike, and the guy on T side was like saving his AWP in the T spawn. But because there was four CTs left, they obviously like slowly were trying to push in and rush him, right, to try and get the AWP from him. And because as they came up, they accidentally timed it wrong, and they all sort of came one after another, and he killed like three of the people or whatever. The crowd was going wild while this was happening. And I remember even on the cast just being like, I mean, all these kills are obviously completely inconsequential, and he is just saving right now. This isn't a scenario where he can win the round. And I remember people were just hating it, mate. They were just like, wow, you're just sucking all the joy out of the game. You're ruining it. And I had a similar thing happen in CSGO. Like early on, I think it was actually DreamHack Summer 2014. I did a match where Shox's Epsilon, which was like a really ropey lineup after he left Titan, played against, I think it was Na'Vi actually at the time, when they still had like Edward and Seized and Guardian. And basically, this was a really bad semi-final. It was one of those matches where the team with more skill just makes all the fucking errors in the game, and the team that's bad just benefits from them, and it makes the game look close, but it's just a bad game from both sides. And again, I was too critical. People just hated it. Even though, by the way, it was bang on analysis. I was doing a great job of giving you a sense. So what I was trying to do was explain to you, like, you know, just because he's won the round doesn't mean that was a great play. Actually, sometimes this guy made a mistake here, even though he was in end up working out. And people in general didn't like how dry it was, and they didn't like the fact that I was critical. And so what's hilarious is, you can even go watch the first tournaments I do in CSGO. Dude, the first year, all I am doing is analysing the game like any analyst does. In fact, I would say every analyst copied me. Spoiler, there were no pros who did analysis in CSGO. Me and Richard were the first people. There was, you would invite a player who finished a match to come on the desk, but aside from that, it was basically casters, or me and Richard were the first ones. And when I would do it, you can go watch, I just analyse it like you would. Oh, they lost the two pistols there. It was always going to be hard. I thought fourth round, they got... Now, here's the thing. I can do that. In fact, by the way, if you ever heard me comment, I think I'm even good at that. The point is, Yanko's probably better at it, and he's specialising in it. So what I learned, and this is actually the epiphany, sadly, no other talent's ever come up with. Every other talent dude only cares about themselves, and they're all just trying to be the knowledgeable caster. I just looked around and was like, wait a minute, in a world where Yanko comes in, and I know he's in every demo, because remember he was the observer, then Maniac's coming in, and Maniac was not only a pro, he was part of the tactical base of all of his teams. Why the fuck would I take up all their time talking about the tactics? Why don't I just let them do that, and I'll just specialise on my shit? If you remember, that was actually when I invented the premise of analysing the fucking veto. Everyone now is going to go, you didn't invent it. There wasn't a thing. Nobody talked about that back then, or if they did, here's how they talked about it. Right, Nips picked Nuke? Well, I mean, I remember they were quite good at it once, and I, you know, this player played, like, they never knew the stats, they never knew what your veto pattern was, they never knew why you pick it against a certain opponent. I specialised on that because I thought, again, I come from, I used to love watching Dota for fun. I was like, I want a bit of that on the desk. I want a bit of, like, the, a different style of analysis. That's equivalent to the draft, isn't it? So the point is, like, this all, like, I didn't, like, sit down and figure this out in the past. Like, it was a mixture of, I would have an idea, I would go down that direction, I'd learn the skills there. In this particular case, I mean, in the case of the desk, sometimes less is more, right? I remove certain things from my analysis. So the funny thing is, I do think if you look at my career, the real joke is, much like, let's just say, some famous conspiracy people, you know how the way you dismiss them is you go, oh, yeah, he has loads of great info, but why is he so bombastic? Why does he say ridiculous things? It's like, well, name one that doesn't. Oh, you can't, because you only actually follow drama. That's the only thing that can get your attention. So all I would say is that is... all the people who tell me, like, ah, oh, you just, I like the old you. I wish you'd just go back. So they don't. That's just a total lie. They just mean they're triggered, basically.
Everything you're talking about is like finding your voice, basically. And I feel like that is a process of, oh, it's almost like making some missteps, seeing a gap in the market. You're almost talking about like free market economics and stuff. Like, you've sat there and said, like, oh, this piece is missing from this broadcast, this piece of the puzzle. What if I jump in there and fill that? Nobody else is doing that. In fact, that's a big part of how you find your voice when it comes to, you know, like content creation, or in your case, like being on the air and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
So. I guess going back to that to some degree, when you were in those moments, was it more of the retroactive analysis of your own commentary, or was it just a feeling you had where you were like, ah, shit, I shouldn't have been like too hard about that. I should have been a bit more playful with the commentary, or like the way that they're making mistakes, rather than the go-to analysis for it? Like, what would you say?
Oh, I see what you mean.
How did you process that, you know?
I mean, first of all, I would say, just for the key distinction, I don't think I did a bad job in that cat. That's exactly what want as a caster, and I would do it again tomorrow with a shit-eating grin on my face and collect the fucking money all the same. But I understand, essentially, that other people didn't like it, or it wasn't sort of the... Basically, I also learned from, like, observing the other people who are my friends who are casters. Like, there's a reason why they always have to have, like, an upbeat tone. I'll give you a little reason as to why I actually am one of the only people to specialize in being an analyst. So that might even shock some of you. You might think, well, Moses was a great analyst. Oh, of course, Sponge was a great... None of these people wanted to be an analyst, by the way. If they'd have been given a choice from day one, they would have been a color commentator in a duo like they are now. Because for most people, it's the opposite. They want to talk for 2 hours. They want to be the star of the show. They want to create the moments. They want to feel part of the match. They want to make the call. They want to say, I was there. What they don't realize is this. What I learned from that experience was I can't do 2 hours because I can't be fake for 2 hours, and I would never do that anyway. So it's going to be a bad experience for a lot of people if it's a 2-hour broadcast. But I tell you what, if I'm only talking for 2 minutes or 30 seconds, that's a manageable dose. Even if you don't like me, I can just be a villain then. You can just accept it for 30 seconds and you watch the game. So I figured out for me, it's way better to be an analyst. It's why I've actually recommended it to some people who did not listen to me, although in certain cases, it was also dependent on what was available in the industry. Like I told Dust ages ago, Dust, your problem is this, mate. I think you're good, but unless people inherently like you, they won't listen to you for 2 hours. It doesn't matter what you're saying, how good it is. It doesn't matter how on point it is, how appropriate it is. If they don't like you, because here's the problem. My actual conclusion of casting is the only thing that matters is, do you like him or don't you? Like, you guys might think a totally different opinion. I personally think James Bardolph is bang average, but I get that people love him, and the people who love him think he's the best. So even though it doesn't make sense to me, I think that is the normal distinction people use. Now, in terms of like the idea of like, could I figure out them? No, basically all the things I do basically go off a mixture of like feel. And then I would say almost, I have when I try to think about things like that, it's more like I put my mind into like a state of abstraction where I just let it go where it wants to go, if you know what I mean. I feel like I'm almost not the one with control of my mind in that regard. So I let it sort of analyze what I'm doing and tell me what to do next or what the angles are and just feel it out, basically. Like most of the things I'm talking about now, by the way, I will also say, like everyone, you also do make the story way better when you think back on it and you can create a narrative around it. Obviously, it's going to get way smoother and connect more and seem like, oh, this followed that. But in the moment, you don't really know. I'd say it's more of a sort of a whirlwind in the moment, and it's after the fact you piece it together.
Now, I know that you've mentioned before that you're a fan of like certain stand-up or stand-up comedy. Would you draw more kind of like to the fact that there's like the Jeff Dunhams of the world, or the I can't remember the other dude, but there's a larger Mexican comic. He's like a household name in a lot of families, and you know, like those are a lot.
Milk toast.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you.
What's like, the premise here? Like, what's the angle of what they're doing?
The angle is that they're kind of like household names, that they're friendly, that like Jeff Dunham, you know, like when I was growing up, when I was a teenager, like my parents liked him, or like Larry the Cable Guy, where okay. there's like comics like Dave Attell, who it's a comics comic, right? Like he's like the upper echelon of like the
right. So the first set of group of people are sort of the crowd pleasers for the guy who's just going to a random comedy.
He's selling out the stadiums where this person is working, like they're working the clubs, and they're like the comics that are touring, the comics that are out there working it, all respect Dave Attell more than like Iglesias or like the Jeff Dunhams, because it's more like hacky and it's like more abroad. I'm not going to say hacky. I mean, clearly they're successful enough where people enjoy them and watch their content. But with casting, do you think there's something to that where there's like I consider like in a like a legendary status, this is just my opinion, but yeah, like Doa, Monty, I think you're up there. There's some other casters that I enjoy listening to you guys talk and the way that you approach the game, but how you're light with it, but can also have the bants, but serious when it needs to be. And I would put you up in that like Dave Attell, because like if I go around and somebody says they watch LCS or they watch CSGO stuff, I'm like, have you heard of Thorne? They're like, eh. It's like, oh, sure. But if I go like, do you know who Captain Flowers is? They're like, oh, fuck yeah. So,
oh, of course, yeah.
To that degree, you know, I don't have too much more to add.
No, I get what you mean. I would also say, by the way, that is actually, there's a very similar divide in esports, I would say. So I'll give you a random example. Obviously, the last 3 years, it's been really popular in CSGO to hate on Semler and say he's trash and every single other caster in the world's better. Spoiler, try asking an actual play-by-play caster what they think of Semler, and they will tell you he's a god. Like, he has unbelievable control, like, knows how to work the crowd, can hype it, at the same time, doesn't get, I mean, a point we've been stressed on by the numbers, he never gives away any information in an arena game. By the way, a lot of the people you guys have promoted the last few years, and probably say number one, I've seen them fuck up rounds in massive tournaments by not knowing the difference between casting from your bedroom and casting when that might leak into the player's mic. Like, there's certain things, again, it's like you're saying, in the same way as the comic is the idea, like, you can see what's brilliant about what he's doing, and also he's probably going to a degree the other guy doesn't, and you can tell when he's crossing the line and he's willing to be on light and stuff. Like, there's definitely the people like that. Like, I would even say personally, that's an area that, I mean, one of the most shocking transformations to me was to see the reputation of Monty, where like now people genuinely act as though like he was kicked out of casting and that he's trash and he couldn't hang and he doesn't know anything about the game, which is bizarre, because if you don't know, I'll always say it like this: Monty was LS before LS. He was the person who had the different way of thinking and his own total model, and he was the one who knew more about the Koreans than everyone. He was LS before LS, and he even had the status where like lots of pro players were messaging. And by the way, spoiler, loads of people were asking him to coach them, even despite what they all joked about in public. Oh, and I've also had that happen as well. Here's an interesting detail you might like. You know how I'll often get like low level tier one pros come at me on Twitter or imply like they don't care what I think, I don't know anything. What's amazing is through my career, I would say here's the divide. Publicly, low level pros diss me, spoiler, because I'm probably critical of their team or say they're not as good as someone else. As a general rule, the people who DM me privately are the like GOAT Hall of Fame players. And they all like, I loved your point. I thought you made a great one on that. Even if it was unpopular. Like, that's what's hilarious. It's like the divide is so ridiculously transparent if you sort of know what position each person's coming from.
Something that confuses me about that, though, is based on discussions like you've had or Monty or similar, like the various shows. I don't remember if it was Revenge by the Numbers or like Summoning Insight. But near as I can tell, it seems like the talent does not move the needle at all in terms of the broadcast, right? It seems like for the vast majority of fans, like whether it's you who's on a desk or anyone else, like they're probably going to have roughly the same amount of people. And yet there still is this tendency to just hire the people, or at least largely hire the people who have indexed into just being like that pleasant talking voice or kind of what you're talking about in that sense. And it just kind of seems odd that, like, obviously, yeah, they have to sell a product and they have to sell to the plebs or whatever, but it doesn't seem like the talent in many of these, you know, cases, whether that's League of Legends or CSGO, actually do that in a meaningful way beyond just, like, the quality of the games or, like, the specific teams that are playing in the case of, like, you know, like, MIBR or something, or, like, Na'Vi or something like that in CSGO.
I mean, that's actually an area, by the way, that tilts a lot of very legendary casters. Like, I think Anders is someone who might even have spoken about this publicly. What tilts them is, it's not that we don't move the needle. It's that we are not given access to any kind of metrics to know if we move the needle. And they do that on purpose, by the way. Riot won't let you know. ESL won't let you know. So what they won't do ever is do things like give you very, very detailed breakdowns of like demographics of where people come from during a match. Or like, because if they gave you all that, you can see the obvious problem that would arise. What if it did turn out that Anders gets you 1.5 times the viewers that random person Scorny does? Well, guess what? That completely changed the landscape of who you hire and how you hire them and what they cost and whether they know they have leverage over you. Spoiler, no company in esports will ever let you get leverage over them if possible for obvious reasons. So the main issue is like, that's more like when I say that, I also mean like specific to an event. Like, for example, I would guess almost certainly Monty and Doha did affect the viewership of like OGN. But the point is, like, one match won't affect. But yes, if you watch like 3 months of them, I've no doubt that created the whole culture of the broadcast. And so, like, in a long enough time span, I think it probably does affect it. And I think it, on the margins, I think it probably does affect certain things like demographics and what type of person, maybe what caliber of person is listening. Maybe on the shitcast, the same numbers there, but it's a 14-year-old pleb. Maybe on the cast for Monty, it's a 28-year-old guy uploading mobile with disposable income. That would be interesting to know, right? But as you can see, even though it might sound conspiratorial, spoiler, this is just the way it works behind the scenes, you can imagine Riot doesn't want Monty to know that he's a more important caster. ESL doesn't want Anders to know that this guy is. That's one of the problems we've got in that regard. So, and I think the other angle as well to me is this. All we're using is the feedback right now is public comments, right? Like Reddit comments, Twitter comments. It's like I've always said, if I have a video on YouTube that has 70,000 views and 100 comments telling me it's shit, I don't even know that even more than a fraction think it's shit. I can't. In fact, logically, there might be tens of thousands think it's awesome and just didn't comment or thumbs up or whatever. But instead, what we do in esports is we just look at the 100 comments and we're like, right, that's everyone. So that's the audience. Oh, they're not liking this one. And so I already think we're a bit lost when we try all those things. Like, the main problem is, I think intentionally, the people behind the scenes who know where the levers are, they won't tell us what the mechanisms are, how it works. So on that one, I don't really have too much to say, basically, because I like I said, it still ends pretty open-ended, but I just suspect there might be some areas where there's probably a bit of wiggle room. I mean, the main problem in general, by the way, is like, spoiler, people just turn up to watch the match. I think that also applies to sports. Like, you can have the best casters, you can have the best talent. If the match looks amazing on paper, you're going to turn up even if it's dog shit talent. And by the way, the companies knew this way before the rest of us. Like, if you look at the way ESL has hired for the last 3 or 4 years, they've actually ruined casting in Counter-Strike, in my opinion, because they've given all these people at home the perception that they were always going on a shortlist of the best caster, and they just went down the list until someone said yes. It is not at all like that. They have intentionally turned down some of the best casters to take people who sometimes were undercutting, like I'm talking like asking for a third of the money of the other person. That's the way that ESL was hiring. Because what ESL figured out after a while was they used to try and hire the big people. And then they realized you only need a few of the big people. So instead, ESL basically became like, you know those things they do in sports where you get a grid and it's like you've got $10 to spend to make a 5-man team. There's the $5 player, that's like Aaron Rodgers or fucking Mbappe in football. Then obviously it's like the $4 one's going to be like Modric and like fucking, you know, I don't know, some old school player who's still pretty good. And you know, you make your team out of that and it's like, how do you construct it? That's how ESL used to make their events. So what they do is they'd hire, oh, I'm going to get like a $5. I'm going to go Anders and Moses. There we go. Oh, but then I want to go cheap for the next two. So I'm going to go, right, I'll go fucking Vince and Blair. They're my second casters. Then like for talent, well, I've got to have a big name. So I'll get Sponge, but then I'll pair him with Pimp and then just a random guy from YouTube. That's really how they've been constructing it for years. It's one of the reasons why you see me always push back on by the numbers against talent announcements. But to the fans, it just seems like I'm hitting like, oh, you just want the old school people. It's like, no, I want the people who are the best, mate.
I agree with that. I feel like to that degree too, it's made me feel a little bit black-pilled about like the future to some degree of like casting talent. It's why I don't really tune in live to broadcasts, or if I do watch anything.
You want me to give you a white pill? Sure, I've got a white pill right here for you, nice. Mate. Because you're right, the black pill is really bad. Like, spoiler, it's going to get worse. It's going to get like more Saudi cynical. Funding, like, yeah, it's going to get way worse.
Dystopian 1980s.
Mate, just go watch Valorant. It is the most dog shit vanilla talent you will ever see, and explicitly so, because they're all trapped in a mind prison where you will be kicked out of the game by Riot at the drop of a hat. So it's all dog shit. But here's the white pill. Where are all the people that should have been hired? They're all on core streams. I'm doing my watch parties. Spoiler, watch parties and live views can never be shut down. We're not featuring your IP. We're just talking, and if someone happens to have your game open on a totally separate stream, they can sync it up and watch. Like, that is the future, by the way. Like, Core Stream's official ones might not be, but in my opinion, watch parties, and obviously, if needs be, we'll use those websites that LS and fucking Dom had back in the day. That's the future, in my opinion, because that way you can have your own sponsor, your own company. No one can stop you doing the game. You can have whoever you want with you as your talent. Now, listen, no one else has figured out how to do that outside of the Core Streams in terms of monetizing it. So I won't say too much now because I'm not foolish enough to tell you the plan before I've done it. But spoiler, I'm gradually doing it now, so... In the future, my hope is, at least with the people in my circle, you will still hear them. They just won't be on the event. They'll be home with me, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I think that's definitely one of the ways to go, because I was about to say, like, the fact that Riot has the monopoly on the broadcasting rights for all their IPs is one of the reasons that I'm not super invested in watching their stuff, but I still play League, like, very regularly, and I'm inundated with it in terms of, like, the people at my work and the friends that I make. Like, our common thing is League, and we play it, and you know, I'll tune in from here and like here and there, but you're right. It's milquetoast. They have that monopoly. But going back to, I'm sorry, I got a little bit derailed. The monopoly thing, it's like having a way to decentralize the viewing experience to a tailored experience like potentially might happen is something that I think is definitely worthwhile, because that would make me more interested in watching these games. Because right now there's not people like Forgiven. Maybe there are, but I just remember those storylines and those narratives that were crafted by the casters that they purged.
It's they just, like, don't do a good job with them now, mate. That's the main problem. Yeah. Put it this way, like, all I would say in general is this. Let me think how to phrase this. Fuck, what was I going to say there? Let me just think. I'm trying to think what the angle was going to be. Something to do, obviously, with doing the broadcast from home.
Well, you were talking about watch parties. You were talking about them purging the casters. Valorant being kind of like vanilla.
Oh, I mean, put it this way. I'll give you an example. If they really open, like, if anyone could Core Stream, for example, then why would, like, we'd all do the games. Like, instead, because spoiler, instead of just watching the game, you'd make money while you're doing it. It's like Monty would probably Core Stream all the game. You know what I mean? Like, there's another thing. They also, if they wanted to with Riot, they could obviously make this 10 times easier. They just intentionally won't. Like, that's something they're going to limit forever. So, like, basically, oh, I know what I was going to say. There we go. By the way, there's another secret, by the way, if you want, Andy, is if you don't know where you're going, you just talk yourself back to the same place and then you let the neurons fire off and it'll tell you what the next topic was like it was before. Takes a bit of practice, but if you notice, I'm pretty decent at doing it. That's why I don't give up when I don't remember initially. I just find a way to get back in it. So anyway, here's the angle I was going to say was I've basically got like 2 years ahead of this problem, if you think, Eddie. Because the joke is, I tried to change the traditional method. I made my own tournament. It was called Flashpoint. And I was hiring all the talent I wanted. I was setting the show power I wanted. So I tried the traditional method that everyone else in the industry's done. But when I found it fundamentally just doesn't work, and it will never succeed because you have to basically be the monopolizing partner in a monopoly. Once I realized that, the good thing about me is I'll try things many, many, many times and see if they can work. But the second I know they can't work, I'll never waste another second of my time on it. So once I knew that couldn't work, that's why I left Flashpoint. People think I'm just flexing when I say that. The Flashpoint executives were baffled when I told them I was quitting. Because when I told them I was quitting, I told them, like, I'm not going to do this year. Like, I don't like your offer. So they were like, but what if we gave you this? Like, you just have to do half as much work for the same money. It's like, no, I'm going. Like, this project can't succeed. And they were like, but you get the same money, though. It's like, no, you guys don't fucking get it, do you? Like, it's not about the money. So the problem is, like, once I knew that couldn't work, I tried everything I could in that company, mate, from top to bottom. I mean, the joke when I say all that story about the transfers is, what the fuck does that have to do with my purview as the creative director? The joke is I was on the side doing an entire person's job, like an agent, just fucking run that, because I was just trying to get any of the inputs better so that the end product would be better. Once I figured it couldn't work, I instead went this route. And this route now is just do it all myself. Essentially, the problem in Flashpoint was I wasn't the CEO of Flashpoint, so now I have to be the CEO of my company. And spoiler, the good thing about the company I'm doing with Monty is it hasn't got one set direction. It's essentially about getting funding, making money back to as profit, and then it's just a huge pile of money. We can do anything we want for projects with that. Could be documentaries, could even be our own tournaments in a game in the future, could be our own broadcast, it could be anything we want. So that's the future. And by the way, if that doesn't work out, don't worry, I've got other angles too. Maybe then I've threatened it in the past, maybe then then I go micro celebrity. Maybe then half my content's got a paywall and just the first half's free. We'll see. Whatever direction it is. I do think you can create new paths. At the same time, you have to have a little bit of path of least resistance. When you find out something's, if something's really just pushing a boulder up a hill endlessly, you can't do that forever. It won't work out for anyone.
Yeah, I was actually going to tie this back to, I don't know, Paul, if you watched League way back in the day, but before LCS, like
literally from the very beginning.
Oh, okay, then great. You'll know exactly what I'm talking about. Then there was the tournaments before Riot had LCS and the Monopoly, and those were some of the best tournaments. Like, I think one of the funnest probably pieces of League history is going back and watching TSM play against Koreans for the first time against CJ and Displaze. Like, they're just that experience, and like, it's hard to capture in like a VOD, but at that time everyone was going into like, puff, look at this idiot team, TSM's gonna crush them. And it's like, nobody had the idea or the standard of what was about to fucking happen. And then you just see the shattered, like, the reality starting to shatter around these fucking player narratives where it's like, oh my god, is TSM vulnerable? Wait, what is this Korean shit? And then, you know, people start following the Korean League and OGN, yada yada. But tying that into Trick2G was doing for a while of time that was really popular was a Sub Wars. And I thought that was a really creative way to get around the tournament restrictions that Riot has, because even though these players weren't good, like, by all means, there was like the bronze Sub Wars, the silver Sub Wars. These players are shit run-of-the-mill things. But if you have this WWE style commentary storyline, like, the players are in there, their hearts are fucking racing because they've only played silver 3, silver 2 games, but like 600 of them. So they have like 20,000 people like watching while Trick2G is roasting them or hyping them up. Like, that was in that time as fun as watching like Doa and like Monty like cast. Not because of the skill or even the fucking detail of analysis, but the entertainment factor alone. So I think that would be really exciting to see some sort of thing like that from talents and personalities that are too outlier for the vanilla milk toast investors out there. But yeah, that should be interesting.
I think content-wise, things were just so different then, because, like, my introduction to TSM was, like, I think it was the video where Reginald announced, like, hey, we're going to move to a gaming house in New York, and we're going to stream, like, everything, right? And at that time, it felt like it was, like, Big Brother, but for League of Legends.
Yeah, and they had the VODs, too.
Yeah, they had the VODs. Like, they were doing crazy stuff, like, you know, the boxing, saying slurs, whatever they were doing on any given day at the TSM house. But one thing I remember that, like, at the time, it seems so crazy to think about now outside of something like Breaking Point being released, but I remember the day they came back from, I can't remember if it was playing that tournament, the MLG New York or whatever it was where they played the CJ teams, or if it was when they got absolutely shit stomped by M5, but they came back and they had like a discussion, right, about what they were going to do as a team, if they were going to practice more. And this is when the Rain Man was still their top laner. And the Rain Man stream is still live, right? And he's like, oh, I got to go have a meeting. And you can just, like, hear Reginald and them, like, screaming at each other in the background. And then the next day, they're just like, oh, yeah, the Rain Man's no longer part of the team. We're going to be putting in Dyrus or whatever. And it was just like, wait, what? Like, imagining something like that happening today where, like, okay, I guess, like, Impact's just gone from EG and we saw it all happen on stream or whatever seems, like, so far-fetched. And, like, yeah, that's kind of trashy content or whatever, but back then there was just so much fun stuff going on, whether it was, like, Civ HD or, like you said, Trick2G or even Phantom Lord before his stuff came out. And now I just feel like outside – I guess I would say that all of the content on League of Legends now outside of Riot is just commentary on, like, LCS, LEC, LCK, LPL, etc. Whereas back then it was about the game, not just, like, the competitive scene. And I think that drew people to the competitive scene, whereas now, like, when I think about, like, LEC, you know, people talk about how great the LEC's content is or whatever, but it's like, I don't care how many songs they make or, like, how many rap battles they do. I don't really care about, like, the Kobe versus Dash, like, fight thing, because it's not about the game, really. And it's, like, very, even in the case of, like, the LEC songs, like, sure, I guess they're kind of talking about playoffs or whatever, but it's just not about the game. And I feel like that's where stuff used to be.
Yeah, I just want to add for a correction. It was Azubu Blaze at the time, and it was the MLG 2012 Summer Arenas. But yeah, I did.
It was New York, right? I just want to. Yeah.
The arenas were all in the New York. Yes. Actually, if you don't know, the arenas were the pay-per-view tournaments.
Oh, yes, that's right, because you had to buy StarCraft the 720. Well.
Yep.
You had like a 364.
It was actually one of the early Western tests of pay-per-view, and unfortunately, that particular one I don't think did that well. It was only really the OGM one that took off, and GSL, obviously.
Interesting. I think that they could benefit, too, from bringing the pro view back. That's another reason why I'm not as interested, because I think...
The problem with that is I can actually give you some insight there, because sure. As I always go to pains to point out, I literally own part of the company that made ProView, and it has nothing to do with Riot as a company. It's a Swedish company. It was called Snipe, and it was the one that, if you remember back in CSGO in 2017, I actually did a bunch of... Funny enough, like this, almost like watch party type content, where, if you remember, there was one where it was me and Get Right and Lurpis and... There was another one where it was like Lurpis and Semler and I think Pimp was at one. Like that was the one where we had the argument about the AWP or whatever. We basically did these ones where it was like a watch party. It was almost like actually the Joe Rogan fucking MMA things. It was almost like a live view, one of those wild games were going on. We did it during some like DreamHack somewhere. I remember we did like I Am Kind of Eater, the one that Fnatic won over FaZe Clan with Carrigan. So we did a bunch of those anyway. So that company, because... Like any proper tech company, it's not about like what you're doing now. It's about what is the tech. They actually had some proprietary tech basically that was like streaming tech and that it was like super smooth. And as you see in the pro view, you can make a timeline of when every significant action happens. So in League, obviously it's like when a tower gets taken, when a fight happens, when a death happens, when you smite, whatever. You can do all that stuff and make it super easy to view and scales down. Into... So basically it was a brilliant product. I mean, obviously, spoiler, I do own part of it. So you might think I would say that, but that's actually not the way I am at all. Like, I thought Flashpoint was dog shit while I was at Flashpoint. But the problem it had was this. All I can basically say is this, Eddie. It was actually killed because Riot doesn't understand the premise of anything except like absurd success. So the joke was, even though it obviously literally makes money, like how could it lose money? Obviously can't, can it? And it's just subscription. Even though it made money, what was communicated to me was it hadn't scaled up enough. So they just killed the whole thing. Because, spoiler, this will be a trend. You'll notice that me and Richard Lewis nailed about Riot 10 years ago, and it still holds. If they ever have to choose between more money and more success for everyone or ultimate control for Riot, they will always choose the latter. Riot are the company where they've cut off their nose, their eyelids, their ears, they've gouged out their own eyes, all just to spite their own face. They're never going to let anyone else ever have success unless they're the ones getting the majority of it. So the logic here was, if only X amount of people buy ProView, that's not enough. I want, like, you know, I want to make millions and millions and millions of dollars off it. So they just, even though there's a million angles of like, well, maybe you didn't implement it right. Like, you'll probably know this. They only did certain regions or that it was only at certain times and the way it was implemented because of COVID was mad scoffed, etc. So despite all that, as far as I know, they basically just fucking killed the project. Because as usual, just like they did with OGN being subscription-based and making millions of dollars and pay for Monty Live there, they made that go free as well. Riot has killed so many golden geese. It makes me sick when they then turn around and go, we need to figure out how to make money. It's like, oh, fuck you. There's about 50 people trying to turn straw into gold. You killed them all, you idiots. Just Riot in a nutshell.
Yeah.
Andy, you must have an angle on this, mate. You've been a bit quiet on this show. So come on, let's... The other thing as well is, even though people did a pretty good job there, talk show style, like feeding topics into each other, we could take a total detour if you want. So where do you want to go here, mate?
Oh, let's take a detour. Okay, so something I've been really wanting to... It's been kicking around in my brain is... I often try and explain to people how amazing CSGO is, why I like it, why it's more interesting to me than any other game or any other sport. And here is the best sort of explanation that I've been able to come up with when I'm talking to someone who doesn't play any video games, you know, like complete normie. I say it's a little bit like chess, because there's parts of a round where, you know, maybe you're on offense, maybe you're on defense. Sometimes you sacrifice a piece so that you can get a counter kill, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's a little bit of hide and seek going on in there. You literally hide in a bomb site so that people don't know where you are. They don't know if you're going to be in the corner. They don't know if you're in that little cubby hole. There's a little bit of tag. Even if you know where someone is, you have to tag them, as in shoot them and kill them. Plus, there's the first person sort of shooter elements in there, reflexes, all that kind of stuff, all rolled into one and played on seven different fields, as in different maps. When I tell people that, especially the part about like hide and seek and that sort of stuff, they get super interested. Is there anything you guys think, the three of you think, that I'm missing in my explanation of what Counter-Strike is? Like, is there any other element of the game that you guys would add if you were trying to convince someone to watch or play the game?
I don't know about if I was trying to convince someone to watch or play the game, but I feel like I'm not hearing the sort of economic part being Oh, like, yeah. Cloud, right? Because I guess one of the big things is, like, as we talked about before the show started, whatever, like in League of Legends, when you're losing, you just stay losing forever. But in CSGO, like, because, you know, the rounds change and the loss bonuses and win bonuses or whatever, there's like a chance for people to come back essentially, or like to make huge comebacks. And I think that that's actually one of the, like, obviously upsets are what they are, but I think that comebacks in CSGO, or like, you know, going to overtime and things like that between two really competitive teams because you had a bad start, still being able to express your skill is a really cool element of it. That's kind of like in chess, that doesn't exist. Like once you're behind, you're kind of shit out of luck.
Sure, but other games have like comeback. Yeah, I guess. Not, it's not as rewarded as well as Counter-Strike. Like, I guess if you're massively down in a basketball game, unless you're like fucking Michael Jordan or something, you're probably not going to pull some bullshit out and come back.
I would add that it's one of the exciting parts, at least for me, between League and CSGO. One of the reasons why I prefer to like watch a CSGO over a League, or even at times prefer, but like I wish that I could play it, is that it's very explosive, where like in League, the support player will never just like pop off and kill all five people if they're down in this situation. If the support is the only person left, it's like, oh, the team fight's over. In CS, there's always the opportunity, like if even if you're on pistols, that person could pull off this crazy moment, and that becomes a highlight of the thing, the tempo swung. And it's just, you know, besides like a bomb actually being exploded, like the tempo and like the feel, like a boring game can become very exciting, like in a snap of a finger. So that's something that I might add. But I think other than that, when you were explaining it, I think that's a very concise and great way to like draw somebody in without having to like add on to layers of layers. Like, I think I also might not mention the economy thing, or just briefly mention it, even though that it is very important, because it can get convoluted and very like hard to explain. I would just basically say there are different guns that you can buy, and there's a money system, but it's, you know, there's a lot of detail to that.
I've got a few angles on this, because the main thing is, like, if you want like a one line version, you basically have to do it like Artorias did about StarCraft, where he had some line where it was like, it's like chess ballet or some shit like that. He had some like fucking weird, like some tagline to do. So if you want like a bunch of angles of how you describe it, like I've got a few for you, because generally I would say it's more like you want to give people like themes and trends. But as you said, Andy, ideally you want to make it sound like, well, wait a minute, what's that going to, like I'm not an expert about the game, but I get what you mean by that. Like, essentially, you want to strip out the game mechanics and just make it as sort of simple as possible. So I would say, for example, when you contrast the tactics part, the two sports I actually think are most useful to contrast with are, I think if you know the NFL, because obviously the offense has like a set of strategies and a playbook and all that jazz, and then in tennis, if people don't know, probably the most misunderstood part about tennis, if people don't follow it, is you're not really just reacting and hitting the shot. All the great players are constructing points. Like, this shot I hit so that when you return it to a specific area, I'm then going to hit this next shot, which puts you out of position, and then I hit the winner. Like, that's, in fact, if you ever watch a bit of tennis and you're just a casual, it's one of the reasons why the most classic matchup was Nadal versus Federer, because the joke was Federer was hitting shots that were constructed to be winners against anyone else, and then Nadal would return the shot, and you'd be like, shit, what happens now? Like, it made for this really crazy dynamic because the best player in the world just kept getting stomped by this one guy. So that's what I'd say on the tactics part. Essentially, it's a mixture of like tactics, but also, just like tennis, it's massively about conditioning. It's not just what you do now. It's the game plan of, by doing a certain thing a number of times, I set you up for then when I come in with the equivalent of essentially the haymaker, the knockout punch, as it were. Then I'd say, like you said, on the fact of the hide and seek and that stuff, there's another interesting angle. It's obviously not at all like sports. In sports, you can see the whole field. You can look at everyone. In theory, you can see every competitor at all times. Well, just like there's the fog of war in StarCraft and League, in CS, obviously you can't see through the walls, so there's an information deficit. You are always working with imperfect information. So even the smartest player in the world might not necessarily make the right read. That's where things like, I would say, that a fascinating aspect you connect to that is, that's why communication is so important, because since I can't see the whole map, but I might be the in-game leader, well, the problem is, if you're shit and you're my teammate and you give me really bad comms, I might make a bad call. But if the person giving me the comms was like NBK and they were fucking on the money, maybe I make an amazing call and you even think I'm a better IGL than I am. So information deficit's a key quality that's different. For the map part, I would just describe it as, what makes the game unique is because we have different terrains, each terrain as a general trend is slightly different from the others, and as a result emphasizes and sometimes even limits certain skills and styles. So as a result, whereas in football, essentially, I mean, they do it with like formations and stuff, obviously. Whereas in football, you play on the same pitch and it's the same scenario. Obviously, in this case, if you're in CSGO and you're a tactical team, you're probably pushing it to nuke or overpass. If you're the fragger team, you're probably going to Mirage, Cash and Dust too, right? I think once people know that, that's already an interesting part, because what you're sort of pointing out, and this is a thing that sports doesn't have outside, as far as I know, of things like golf, is there's no handicapping in sports. Like, you can't make a match up even. If I'm just way better than you, like the basketball match, I'm just way better than you. What if there was a court where Michael Jordan's skills weren't as appropriate and someone else's skills were better? That would make the sport really kind of have a different vibe to it and a different thrill when even the veto comes up. Then a couple more things for the economy angle. I would describe that, because I think this is like a more abstract understanding of what the economy does, and that's interesting. The angle I would tell people with the economy is if they've ever played either a collectible card game, Magic the Gathering, Pokemon, Yu-Gi-Oh, or even just like a classic card game, like if any of you guys know the game Knockout Whist or Top Trumps or something. Because if you ever play those games, like what you're doing is, yeah, we could both get dealt the same hand, but it's the order I play the hand in and in response to what you're doing that makes my strategy, right? So, for example, if anyone's ever played a game like Top Trumps or Knockout Whist, games where basically the active person selects, like, right, this is the suit, and so if I play this card, anyone who hasn't got a higher one, I win. Like, there's actually a simple tactic in that if you've never played against casual people, where they never understand that you can just, like, trick them by putting your, like, second highest card, then they all have to put out their trump, and then you just have an undefeated win because you have, like, the highest trump, you just win the next. Like simple stuff like that. Like, it's not about the cards, but because think about it, that's the classic thing people love to hear in real life. It ain't the hand you dealt, it's how you play it. So if you let them know, that's what the game's like as well. It's not just, are you taller than this guy? Are you stronger than this guy? Do you have a better teacher? There's also, there really is a dynamic element of using your brain. Because then I would say you lead to what I think are the best qualities of Counter-Strike. So contrasted with any other esports game, I don't think there's another esports game outside of the 1v1 games where an individual player can have more impact than in Counter-Strike. Like, the reason why I could tell Simple was the GOAT long before he started winning championships and everyone else held him the GOAT is because I could really just watch this guy in every scenario, because the game doesn't snowball against you like League and Dota. If you have to give this guy a gun every three rounds, even if his team's losing, he's going to tear your ass up. And it doesn't matter how bad his teammates are, you look at the cross, he's still killing everyone. Like, that's a mega compelling angle, because it means, oh, don't worry, if your favorite player's on a bad team, he can still perform. But then this is how you draw him right back in. So in theory, the absolute best player could win a game himself, but as a general rule, the best team still wins over even the best individual. That's mega fascinating. Like, the analogy I would give there would be, when you think about FPS games, especially people from League and StarCraft, they're all going to think, oh, it's all just about aiming, isn't it? It's like a precision aim, like the best aimer wins. It's like, it's nothing like that, you idiot. Like, what's mad is in Counter-Strike, the best example ever would be, if you go watch Katowice 2019, how could that team Liquid lineup ever lose to Ents? It's impossible. Like, you are aware, like, there's probably not a single player on Ents, if you did, like, roll for roll, who's better than the players on Team Liquid. They're all way more skilled and better aimers. But Ents convincingly won, because that's also what's fascinating about Counter-Strike. As much as it seems like it's about aim and just raw skill, the other elements can also dominate in a different regard, though. So to me, the best thing about Counter-Strike to me is actually that it's a smorgasbord. It's just got all the best qualities of most of the esports.
Yeah, and somehow it works, and it's not like messy, because you could see it easily going wrong. Like, the fact that there's so many different, like, almost genres of sports or games, like, meshed together.
Oh, of course, yeah. Concepts. Yeah,
but it works. And one thing, if I can sort of...
By the way, as an aside, I actually think that's where League of Legends has lost its way, mate. You know one thing no one ever mentions? I'll tell you one thing that sucks about League of Legends. Because of all the objectives, half the time there aren't 5v5 team fights. By the way, a 5v5 team fight is the most satisfying thing to watch in League of Legends. There aren't 5v5 team fights. It's just shit skirmishes around objectives. And then secondly, when you have an actual 5v5 in League of Legends now, it is just chaos. It is someone firing 1,000 fireworks off at once, and your eyes can't watch it all. You can't see what's happening. If we're talking about 7 years ago, guys, any of you who watched early League of Legends, you know what a boring Korean 5v5 team fight front to back looks like. You know exactly what the tank's doing, what the support was doing. You can see the carries. You're looking at the burst from the mid laner. You're watching the sustained DPS from the ADC. It's poetry. It's synchronized swimming. It's ballet. It's incredible. It's a boxing match. The problem with what they've done now in League is I think they've actually ruined the game in that regard. Like they've actually made it chaos. Like what you're saying is, because what's funny is, Andy, you actually would expect Counter-Strike to be like that. You'd think, right, it's just 10 guys with guns and then they meet up and start shooting each other. But obviously when you watch it play out, it's more like I said, the old team fight. Like there's a structure, you know, the entries meet the initial people, they battle them, then in come the flashes, then a lurker picks off a guy flanking. Like there actually is like almost structured element to the way the game plays out that feels satisfying, even though everyone's making all these totally potentially disparate individual decisions.
Yeah, it feels like chess. It feels like chess. And I think an extra thing that we didn't talk about is we kind of talked about it when you said that you can have one player who can just sort of dominate. When your teammates die, they're out of the round. I can't think of any other sports. Maybe there is one, but I can't think of anywhere you literally eliminate your teammates and the game still goes on. Maybe like dodgeball or something. But is that a sport?
I was going to say
World of Warcraft Arena is like that, yeah. As well as like old Gears of War. There's been a few games. I don't know beyond that. Rainbow Six Siege, I believe, as well. There are some. Not to like negate your point, but continue.
But talking, I should have clarified. I was talking specifically about like comparing to sports. I can't think of any other.
My bad. Oh, right. I see what you mean. Okay.
And when you explain that to normies, they're like, well, that's a very interesting concept. Like, imagine you're playing tennis, like doubles tennis or something, and one person has to sit out for the rest of the point or the rest of the game.
Fair. Or imagine volleyball where you just lose somebody like, throughout the round, and then you're down to one person trying to set the ball up for themselves and try and spike it. Yeah.
Yeah, and they can still clutch. And maybe they get to another thing we talked about is you guys kind of talked about it with the economics and stuff. You can pick up the enemy's guns. What a weird concept that is. That's an insane concept. And you can throw guns to your teammates. So I can say, hey, Simples, we're going to make a little old school joke here about how they never used to do this. But you could throw the better gun to Simple and he'd go, oh, no, it's okay. I don't need that. But you could.
I think what you're touching on here is actually a great point and another thing that League has never done, which is like maybe besides like the outlier example of Pike, there's no direct way of giving money to your teammates.
You can't share the economy.
Yeah, the economy is on the player. So like if that actually makes it so there's certain damage supports that, you know, it makes the game weird because they end up getting all the money. And then the carry who's supposed to be carrying the game is like negated to some degree. So I think that is actually a great point to make.
So I was going to say Ornn and Yuumi to a certain degree, right? Because Yuumi obviously gives you stats via the W passive, and then
Ornn, I guess
no, but he means to specific. Like, he doesn't mean make his teammates strong. He means to literally share your economy. So like the equivalent is if I have 9K in CS, I can buy you an AWP. Like you can't buy me like my third item. You
can't
know what
give
I mean?
Me an hourglass.
Yeah, exactly. He means more like that.
But yeah,
would the game be better or ruined? Because I've thought about that. Like in Dota, you can buy like a tome of knowledge and anyone can buy that, which just gives you an extra level. That's about all the sharing you can do between teammates. And I've always wondered, do you guys think the game like LOL would be better if you could like directly donate?
I hate funnel metas so much.
I just think the game is designed in a way where it just, it would be a different game with that kind of dynamic because it's been so integrated with that, with the degree of the money coming, you have to get it. Besides, again, like Pike or like, I guess you could consider.
I'll tell you what would be fucking hilarious on like a banter level is if you think about how people mauled already about how every team that loses in a game of League of Legends is shit and made all the mistakes. Mate, imagine if they had that feature from Dota where you can like drop the fucking gem or like the fucking rapier or something. Could you imagine if someone like caps ints and then just drops like his fucking Medjay's or something and you can just pick it up? Like, dude, the level of mauled would be insane. Like, they're already bad enough as fans anyway. Like, because some of the stuff, if you don't know, like the player to watch for this in Dota is a guy called Eternal Envy. Like this was the guy where basically he was playing like that on the edge all the time. He was either gonna like carry the whole game or like be the solo reason you threw the whole game and fuck
like
everything.
Zhao almost?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it would definitely add another element to the game that's not there. But I think, again, yeah, there's just, that's so out there that it's outside of Riot's little protected thing that I don't even think that it would be League if that was the case. But that doesn't mean that I wouldn't be more open to some sort of thing like that, but the game would have to change substantially for something like that to even like be
palatable. By the way, The other thing people never get with the narratives, you'll notice, is they can never break outside the fucking game. So if people told you this LEC split about, like, look, so I'll use the Forgiven example you're talking about. Say they tried to big up, like, so the obvious one they're all bigging up now is going to be Neon for Misfits, right? Because he's carried all these games they weren't supposed to win as a backline ADC, doing great teamfight damage, and he's obviously mega on the current meta champions, right? The problem they're going to have is they're just going to go, he's one of the best ADCs, he's the third best in LEC, he's overcome. It's like, their brain is trapped inside the game. Here's how I would draw someone into a game who's never played it. So I'll give you an example. With the Forgiven case, here's what you tell someone. Oh, he plays a role that in theory requires the rest of the team to help him get to a later point in the game where he's strong. And so he's actually supposed to be somewhat conservative early, very responsible, and then allow himself to be carried to the point where he can carry the team. But this guy decided he would invert that dynamic and he would be the solo person from the beginning of the game carrying to every point, that it was the opposite and the team had to help him not get fucked. And if they do that, he can't be beat. Dude, I haven't even really told you anything about the mechanics of League already. That sounds like a fucking movie. Like, I'm in. Because I'll give you an example. If you don't follow sports, this is where people can't even do it in sports, bro. Do you want to know one of the most compelling things about Michael Jordan's career? It's not, by the way, that he won all those championships and he's really cool at hitting clutch shots. It's that if people don't know, nobody who was the league scoring leader ever won the championship the season they were the league scoring leader. He's the only one who did it. So already you can see, he was someone who was a single person who could overcome a team. Like, these are, by the way, just narratives that work in movies. They work in stories, you'll notice. That's what you got to hook people with. The real problem people have is this. You'll notice most broadcast people, they use the term human interest, and they think that just means my mum has cancer and I need to win this game. That's just like cynical human interest, mate. In fact, I even think there's a fucked up element to that. It's almost like becomes a pornography where you're like reveling in how shit their life is, because it's going to make like movie style the last scene good. Except, spoiler, this isn't a movie, this is a guy's life. Like, that isn't that fun to me. To me, the human interest is, like I'm saying there, it's how, what are narratives that people understand, what are the archetypes that they can relate to, and then tie that into the game. If you do that, someone could be compelled to want to watch the game without even really knowing what the game's like. It's why, if you notice, I'll do it in the future, but this is the style of documentary I would make. It would barely be about the game, you know.
Yeah. As in, it would be more about the stories of the people.
I mean, to me, it's not like the reason Doublelift's story is amazing isn't that he's really good at like left clicking in the game. It's the fact that, like, again, contextually, what did he overcome and what region did he come from and who was he battling against? And there never was an North American player who's world. You know, it's all those things that are the really interesting parts, right? The rest is like, it's only at the end you get to the ingot and then he won this game and he was on this champion. That's like more, that detail is not as interesting as the more high resolution narrative, in my opinion.
Yeah, there's a lot of other narratives that are like pretty dark in like the league history that I don't want to just mention them, but like there's like if you look up like Kaox, like he had some shit go on, like besides like the thing with him getting kicked out of the team. So like there are narratives that like just don't get talked about because they don't fit within that predefined riot. They're like, oh, this is not going to sell. We have to stomp this out. Nobody can talk about this. Like, I think to like some degree, it would be interesting to see documentaries of like the people from the early days of League, like when it was like Hotshot GG actually in CLG and like Reginald. Cause like to some degree, look at Skara and like, there's this whole, I don't follow them, but I know that there's like offline TV. So like these people were able to use the start of an esports career to like jump off, build a brand and not even have to compete in the fucking game and make way more than they ever would have been in earnings. So I think it's very interesting to see how these like young players who sometimes start their professional careers at 15 or 16, by the time they're 20 or 21, are able to develop either their own brand, organization. I mean, early on in League, if anybody knows, like Ocelot, like him on SK, and then who's the owner of G2? Isn't it Ocelot? Yeah.
Yeah, it is Ocelot.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so Kalos, like that right there.
It's because
right?
He changed his name, obviously. Yeah.
Yeah. So like I was having a hard time like pairing the two. But, yeah. But yeah, Carlos, I mean, that would be a documentary about his life would be fucking amazing. Because one, he also has the personality for it. Like he talks shit and he's not afraid to talk shit. Like I wish there was more shit talk in esports, honestly. And that's why I kind of tune into content like this to some degree, because I don't want the mild mannered stuff. I want, they're all adults playing, they're earning salaries, they can talk shit.
Put it this way, on that note, haven't you noticed how Look, to be fair, at the moment, he's only been on a few of my shows, so I won't take like credit for discovering him or whatever. But I was the first person who put that guy from my Discord, Kira, onto those League of Legends shows. And you can see now, by the way, he's killing it on the Rich Cyber League shows. He's just a guy for real from the Discord. But because I could tell, first of all, he never had any intention of working in the industry. He just has a mad, unfiltered take on everything. But it's, you can see it's super refreshing. I think people get into that, mate. It's a niche angle, but it's nothing like you'll ever hear on a Riot broadcast. I mean, you could even see it on this last episode I did. Like, Amazing, who obviously was a former pro and has done loads of shows, is sat there, and then Kira is doing his analysis. But then the difference is, instead of saying, you know, and then he'll really dominate the bot lane and he won't allow them to get any farm, he's like, yeah, he'll just be stamping on his nutsack all game. And you can almost tell Amazing's going like, What the fuck? What's going on here? Like, but that's compelling, because as you say, like, that's completely outside of the purview of what you would ever get on a show.
Well, I think that part of the problem with what Eddie was saying, though, is like, so like we're talking about Skara or Hotshot GG or, you know, whatever, Chouser, who really cares? The problem becomes that, you know, I was around for that, you were around for that, and, you know, Thorne was around for that, but how many players that are like watching the LCS now know any of that stuff? Like, I don't think the vast...
Oh, you wouldn't go back to that though, mate. Like, I think what you said earlier, one of you know, who was it said about LEC? The problem LEC has is this, mate. They've got more players than ever. They just don't do a good job bringing the right stories, like, you know.
Well, you know, it's like those, like this thing with JoJo, where like the only thing I know about JoJo is he played Fortnite. Like, that's his entire story, and like that's why he's so good mechanically or whatever. And when I try to think of like any recent player, right, you know, Vulcan, who's emerging as the best, if not, you know, one of the best, certainly, supports in the LCS, I know nothing about him other than I think he's from French Canada. But we do have time to make these, like, you know, again, long 8-minute fight scenes or whatever that have nothing to do with the game. And I don't know, frankly, which one would actually do better. Because, again, as we've kind of talked about, I think a lot of the general audience is kind of just looking for that, like, you know, wow thing or the drama thing. And it's entirely possible that a lot of the players just... Like,
by the way, here's a mad black pill for you, because this is a bit wild, but I also do think there's definitely something to it. There's another area that's really dark when it comes to the idea that you can get feedback from people. Like, first of all, as an aside, like, I'm of the school of, like, if you've ever watched that documentary about Alan Moore, where the comic book writer, I actually do think that, like, fans and the audience cannot even know what they essentially need. They can know what they think they want, but they can't know what they need from the artist. That's why the artist is the artist and they're the audience. Like, if they knew what they needed, they would create it for themselves. They would do something that would satisfy them or people like them. So first of all, I'm not even sure the idea that, like, it is a feedback loop and you should follow it really makes sense. Like, spoiler, in my career, I've done a very selfish approach. I've just tried to do the best content I can that I like in the way I do. And if I've got lucky along the way, obviously there was a little bit of work on marketing and stuff, but if I've gotten lucky enough to have an audience, then that's the way. If it wasn't, maybe I'd just be some crazy hermit screaming into a mic with four viewers. There's people like that on YouTube. There really are. So there's that in itself. But then I also think here's the problem, right? You know, when everyone started claiming all the esports numbers were like sexed up or viewbotted or fixed, or, oh, was that real though? How can we know that? And famously, this made me laugh so much. Everyone said, because this really happened, guys, oh, what's going to happen is all those data companies, this happened, like Newzoo, they're going to partner with like proper bodies like Nielsen who do the TV ratings. Well, spoiler, because I'm not a pleb like people in esports, before I talk about a topic like that, I go and look at the test case in real industries. So I looked into Nielsen. Guess what, guys? There is more fuckery with how those Nielsen and all those TV ratings are calculated than your fucking esports Twitch numbers. Way more fuckery. It's, as far as I can tell, that entire industry appears to be like semi-rigged, and you can imagine it's by the top people, and part of it's... I mean, here's the real reason why it can never be really revealed, and it'd be very dangerous if it was. Essentially, this would open a lot of these companies and TV channels probably up to like massive lawsuits from advertisers. Essentially, that's like viewbotting in a way, dude. It's like me lying to the advertiser going, oh, I've got twice as many people as it did, can I have the money then? Like, that would, I can only imagine the fucking shit fest and can of worms you'd open if that actually was ever revealed. But that was the vibe I got, is that it was a very archaic system that they sort of intentionally kept shit so that people could kind of fudge the numbers without saying anything that'll get us removed off YouTube. All I'll say is this: there's a certain way that people think that we like decide who's going to lead us, and we intentionally use really old methods for that as long as they can be rigged. And when they can't be rigged very well, we intentionally only use new methods for that because it's easier to rig. So you can actually sort of see that, unfortunately, like, we're talking in the abstract about an ideal world where we could know what the audience thinks, and but I think we're also, some of that is a little bit it's a little bit like optimistic. It's a little bit naive. I'm not really sure we'll ever get to the bottom of that. Certainly a totally fine abstract conversation to have, though.
Can we jump back a bit to... I was going to say, can we jump back a bit to when we were talking about like human interest? And you were talking about like, you know, there's room for, or maybe you want to do some documentaries on some of those like human interest stories. That was going to be one of my topics of discussion is like, I read this amazing article. It was an old article about Carrigan and his fiance. I've forgotten her name, but they're married now.
Angela something?
Yeah, yeah. And this interview was basically like, it was freaking amazing. She talked so much about his insight and his like the way he prepares for, you know, upcoming matches and stuff. And she said some really amazing quotes that I think speak to him like as a human being and also talked about their relationship and stuff. And one of the ones that jumped out to me was Carrigan already always knows what to do. I just help him make himself more sure of himself. I would love more kind of interviews with people and their family and friends who know them. And, you know, even someone like Simple, you, Duncan, I think it was you, at least I hope it was you, did an article talking about how Simple, it was that quote that he did, that throwaway quote where he just basically said, every game that you play, play as if it's like the most serious match ever or something like that. Or like always play your best.
Oh, I think and I did a video on this. It was like a Thorin's Thoughts video, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you talked about how like, he just plays every single practice match, every single game, as if it's like, this is the only game that ever exists and I have to give 100%. I want to know why he does that. Why the fuck does he do that? Why does he care so much about winning? Why does he want to be the best? Why is he trying to express himself in the game and say, I want to be almost like this is his canvas and he is the artist? Why? There's no like documentaries. There's no articles. There's nothing about any of these people. And anytime something does drop, I just feel so goddamn hungry and I want more because it's so interesting. I watch these people for hundreds or thousands of hours and I never get to know why they do it. Some of the most interesting stuff that you and Richard have talked about is where you hint at some of your backstories, you know, growing up in maybe not the best circumstances and I grinded for this long and I built myself up and I wasn't sure of myself at the start, even like what we talked about at the start of this podcast. I wish there was more of that stuff. And so if you ever did get into that, oh my God, like I'd be the first person signing up. And I think there's a big market for that. I think a lot of people would love to know the backstories behind some of their favorite players.
Sure. Cindy, I want to add in a point too. If you're interested in watching something that may not be from an esport that you're interested in, there's a Smash Brothers community documentary series that a lot of my friends who are very big into Melee and the other Smash games out there like highly recommend. So I don't know what you would have to Google or YouTube to get it, but if you just look up like community made Smash documentary or something like that, there is content out there. It's just not in the lanes that we're in, unfortunately.
I'll give you a recommendation for something. Like sometimes I'll recommend documentaries, right? And the problem is, I actually think most of the documentaries everyone wanks off over, like that fucking free-to-play one from Dota 2. I think they're just average as fuck, man. I think people are just impressed that you had a proper 4K camera or something, or you had a mic on the guy before the game. Like, if you want to watch a mega documentary that is right in the vein of what you're talking about, Andy, and I actually think anyone who is a hardcore nerd for competitive games would fucking love this documentary. It's a documentary about competitive Tetris players, and it's called Order at something like, let me double check. I think it's like Masters. Let me look what it's called.
I want to get the title. Order?
It's called Ecstasy of Order, the Tetris Masters. It came out in 2011. And basically what it does is, in Tetris, like apparently now they do have all these world championships and stuff, but back then they never really used to do like a proper massive world championship. It was just like, because it's such an old game, you know, it was just people individually at home trying to get the high score or reach these levels that like when you reach even the game wasn't supposed to get to that point, so it all breaks down and shit. And like, you know, the idea was like, how long can you survive and how far did you go? And basically what makes this documentary mega is this guy who's the documentary maker, like, wants to gather these people and have sort of like an informal world championship. And actually, like I say, since then this became a thing and they actually do like real world championships and all the rest of it now. But when they did this at the time, what made it amazing was he didn't just get the best players. He got like the people who didn't compete, but they used to just play at home and have an amazing score. He got like a guy who everyone thought was a genius. Well, I'm not even joking. If you've ever seen that movie, The Wizard, it's some cunt who just lived that movie. Like, he really was going around as a kid, like with his dad cynically sort of pimping him out at these game tournaments, winning them all. And he's just some like autistic guy with a massive head, like from Easter Island, going like, all right, dad, what's the next tournament? Like some sort of fucked up thing like that movie, The Wizard, if you ever seen it, the one where the kids go and Fred, whatever's name's playing Mario and all that shit. It's just like that. And what makes this documentary mega is one, they all compete and have given their life just like the old school esports pros. Like what you don't know is when the people like Forrest were at the top in 1.6, you had to win every tournament and get all your salary, and you would get like 30k that year in dollars. Like, it was a shit life. You only did it because you wanted to be excellent, because you wanted to beat those people, because there's essentially a meaning outside of money. So what you find in this documentary is they give you all that backstory, Andy. So you don't just find out this guy plays Tetris. What you find out is this guy had a fucked up childhood and his dad was sort of pimping out. So maybe that's why he doesn't want to be known as the greatest Tetris player ever. Then some woman over here, she's a woman, she's a lesbian, she's some really weird character, and she's got this own thing where she's sort of an outsider from society, and she's trying to sort of like show her identity through playing Tetris. Oh, it's mega, mate. It's all this stuff tied into it, but at the same time it also scratches the itch of like I won't spoil it, but you get to see them compete against each other and go for broke and everything. So it's mega. Like, it's one of those ones where, again, it's hard to get people to watch it because it just sounds shit, doesn't it? Oh, it's about Tetris. But if you're a gamer, it's just the shit, mate. It's mega.
It looks like it's got good reviews on IMDb, so yeah, I'll check that out. I appreciate the recommendation.
I'll even say, by the way, it's not quite Human Interest, but I actually think this is another reason why the actual sleeper OP series I've done, if you're a Counter-Strike fan, I haven't been able to do it, sadly, last year or two due to a mixture of bullshit. It was that one I made called Stratbook. Well, what I did was I got Legia, who a lot of you probably don't know, actually has a pretty good mind for the game, but he's not the best at talking. So I made him my co-host, and then we invited on Carrigan, and it's all the great in-game leaders
that
and coaches.
Episode is great.
We just bring them on, and the point is, look, this is just within the game, to be fair. We don't give you the backstory of who they are, but the idea is we're going to explore their philosophy to the nth degree. So you find out, how does Blade think about Counter-Strike and constructing a team? How does he use a specific player, or what went wrong with a player that didn't? Like, mate, the joke is, in like one fucking 1 hour episode of that, you get way more than like any 3 hour HLTV confirmed or whatever. But the downside is, and this is a little bit of a black pill too, you will notice I'm pretty good at still getting the right people, because I know there's also a lot of tactics, by the way, in how you get people to come on shows and at what time and with what group and with what co-host. But the problem is, if you've noticed, the trend has become much like sports media. Players now are so sensitive, they cannot handle any criticism. And so the reason why they will always love the HLTV podcast is because it is the chillest place ever. No one is going to put the fire to your feet. You're going to get essentially fed grapes while you sit in a toga and are worshipped and fanned by fucking a guy with massive gums and a guy with just a forgettable fucking generic face that an AI generator looks like it made. That's all that's going to happen. You're going to sit back. All the fans are going to tell you you had a great episode. You gave them loads of amazing info. You're like giving almost fuck all away. And at the end, you just waltz off and that's it. The problem is, if you make that alternative and you incentivize it, it's not that people turn my content down. It's just that coming on my content is more of a sort of like gulp. All right, I'm going to steal myself. I'm ready. And they're just not used to that, unfortunately. So the modern pro has been a bit insulated. So it's actually harder to get to that content, I think.
I'm going to take a piss right here, but like, I was going to say, if I'm just taking a piss right here, but could you imagine like an Eric Andre style show with some of these fucking like CSGO pros or these like league players from like Europe just put in a situation where they think they're going into the softball interview to just talk about shit and they just have some psycho just fucking popping off? I mean, content like that, I like movies like Borat for the reason of like just watching people's genuine reactions to stuff. And like, no offense to some of these pros, but they are kind of fucking dry and boring. So it would be fun to see them shaken up.
I mean, I despise it, but that my actual rival did do that, mate. Carmack actually made all that content. What he did was he used to go to events, and if he found out a pro didn't know who what he looked like, he would pretend, like Borat, to be a character called Uzat, and he would go, and it was just a generic Russian. And what he would do is he would interview you, and I'll give you an example. When he was like interviewing and Hawk from StarCraft 2, at one point he mentions something and Hawk sort of just chuckles, and so he goes, why you laugh, why you laugh? And then Hawk gets like really scared, like, oh fuck, is this guy gonna beat me up or something? So essentially, that, like, he already did do that, like, but just like Borat, it's like, here's the thing, mate, I watched the first Borat, I don't need to see any more after that, you know, like that joke gets old for me. So he did do it, but it's probably not even as good as I described it. Like, some of it's probably funny, but some of it's a bit sort of laid on a bit thick, you know.
Fair.
So, Duncan, if you were going to make some of these players more media savvy, I guess, like, or wanting, because a lot of them, when they go on interviews, they are just like milquetoast. Carrigan is a good example of someone who's pretty freaking decent at being on camera and enunciating and talking through. But what would be the first thing you'd do to make some of these players more media savvy?
I mean, I think basically one thing a lot of players do badly is actually what I was touching on earlier about my fellow analysts and casters. You'll notice how, even though I say, like, in the moment, I'm not really reflecting. It's more, again, it's after the fact. You're looking back in hindsight. Are you trying to piece together, like, was what I'm doing there working? Where am I going with it? Other people don't seem to be doing that. Like, none of them seem to still get the idea they have to have their own identity. Their logic, like, I'm not joking. The other people who do on-camera talent seem to think my job is to be top 10 in the world because they hire 10 people. It's like, that's the dumbest way of all time of thinking. The reason why I killed it was I made it so that there's only one Thorin and I'm him. So if you want to hire Thorin, you have to hire me. So I've just nailed it, haven't I? There we go. They haven't got any... I mean, by the way, spoiler, I won't say names, but some people tried to be the budget Thorin. It didn't work out for them in any regard. I mean, the joke is half of them would get themselves cancelled if they really did it, wouldn't they? So... because that's even an area of sort of danger I've included in my career. So the main problem is I would tell most players, I mean, funny enough, it's literally what was on like the Oracle of Delphi in the ancient world, right? Know thyself. That's probably the most important fucking doctrine you need to have. Because the problem is when you go into the interview, what's going to make it awesome is that there's an element of danger. It's like I always say, where even though I fucking hate her as a person and the things she's done, the reason I think Frankie is actually a good interviewer is exactly because she asks annoying questions, because she'll sometimes just throw something in there you're not prepared for at all. That means actually that, yeah, it can totally fuck up an interview, could also give you a quote or an angle you'd never get from a normal interview. You'd never get from the person that they all love, who only asks the safe questions, who pre-prepares and shows them all the questions before. You would never get that. So essentially, I would want them to be willing to go into an environment where it could be dangerous. So that's why the reason you have to know yourself is because yourself is going to be the compass. The reason why I'm never lost for what I'm going to talk about is I talk about what I know, talk about what I think. I don't go, even if I go out with someone else's idea, I'm going to engage with it from my position. I'm not going to be just talking out my ass about something I know nothing about. I'm not going to start down a path of like, oh fuck, I don't know if I'm comfortable talking about it. If you do that, that's how you get lost, in my opinion. The guiding compass has got to be the idea of who you want to be.
How much of the problem how much of the problem is like the players and like obviously just being socially awkward nerds versus the interviewers? Because I feel like what actually turned me on to your content in like 2013 or 2014 was I remember watching those early like Acer interviews or something like that and just being like, oh, there's nothing like this in the entire space. Like, these players are answering really great questions. They seem to be coming out of their shells a bit or whatever. And I feel like even to this day, a lot of the times, like even when it's like post-game lobby interviews or whatever on LCS, LEC, or, you know, even CSGO things, like the players just are kind of awkwardly standing there.
It's because the questions are so awkward, like especially the HLTV ones. Jesus Christ, I can't watch those. They're just so awkward questions.
I mean, I think definitely one of the problems is, I do agree, like if you don't have a good interviewer, it doesn't matter how good the subject is, unless they're like absurdly good, you're not going to get a great interview. They're just going to ruin it themselves. So one of the problems is just a very literal, practical one, which is the job of interviewer is not considered the best. Spoiler, you know how I said every analyst wants to be the color caster except me? I'm the only one who wanted to be the analyst. Every interviewer wants to be the desk host or the stage host. Every stage host wants to be that. You know what I mean? Like, everyone has some other gig they secretly really want to do. And you just start in this gig, you do pay your dues, and you hope they like you enough, you get to move up. If you don't, some of those people, even if they're the best in the world, are actually a bit bombed out, they're stuck in that role, and it feels a bit limited. So the problem is, I do think that we're not sending our best. Like, we haven't incentivized. Like, the joke is, I've said this many times, but it's true. Until this year, or just from the fact that from overall my channel got a lot of sponsorship the last few years, you do realize YouTube itself disincentivizes the content you're talking about that I currently create. Like, I've done thousands and thousands of hours of talk shows, and that's essentially, if you understand the concept of opportunity cost, I was actually giving you guys my money. I was essentially giving back my money I would have made from like a 3-hour talk show. Guys, that's like 5 Thorin's thoughts. Well, they're both just videos on YouTube. I'm going to make like 4 or 5 times less income. Not quite, because obviously the 3-hour one can have more ads, but you get the premise. Like, I'm not actually incentivized to make a 2-hour interview. And so the problem is, at the moment in esports, that, whereas in the real world, think about it, the joke in the real world is when you become an amazing writer, You stop doing everything else. You become just a columnist and you write less because you just do one amazing column in Vanity Fair every month and they pay you $10,000. This is all, I'm talking slightly boomer media because this doesn't exist anymore, but like 90s we're talking here. Or if you're the best interviewer on TV, again, you're not doing a million interviews. You're like David Frost. You just wait and then you interview like the president and it's a massive event. Well, the problem is in esports, I just do that because I'm a weirdo who does what I like to do. If you notice, everyone else just follows the money and they're sort of like just fish going up with the current. So they just get led to wherever they go. So I've always said, one of the reasons I don't have any rivals, part of it's I've done a very good job, but the other part is they all just quit, mate. Like anyone in 2005 who was interviewing, in 2007, they went and joined a site and became the editor and stopped doing any writing and editing someone else's work. Then someone else who was an interviewer went and joined ESL and became a guy working for them. And then someone else joined a team org and then someone became a coach and someone became a... So the problem is everyone eventually moves away because we haven't incentivized these things very well, unfortunately. And then I think it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy. I think a mixture of very cynical TOs like ESL and cunts like Riot who want to control narratives don't want people to sort of go off script. But I also think it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy where when you think to yourself, well, it just has to be like that, doesn't it? Every post-game interview has to start with, how do you feel about the win and what could you have done differently? Like, if you really think that, then you're going to automatically, you're going to put those limitations on yourself. You're only going to hire people who do that. You're going to tell them to do that. You're not going to correct them when they do only that. And you're just going to get stuck in a rut. And I think most people, like, I'll draw the parallel to what I said earlier about the veto. You'll notice it's taken me like half a decade to win people over on the idea of how important the veto is. The real take in CSGO when I started heavily going on that was, it's just like exaggerating. Like everyone knows what the veto will be and you just kind of do it easy. Like they pick their best map, you pick your best map, then you have a just like everyone wanted to believe there was nothing there and so there was nothing there and therefore it only needs 30 seconds. Whereas if you've ever seen my shows when there's like a delay and we have extra time to talk, mate, you can talk very interestingly for 10 minutes about a big veto. Like especially when it's one like with a championship on the line, because as you see, I mean, I pioneered this approach, but I hope other people do it on the Blast broadcast, etc. I don't just tell you they pick this map because they're good on nuke. I'm trying to infer things like, but actually it's about the psychology of they're good on nuke and they know the other team is, but they're saying we're better on it and they know from the last time they played they slightly got the edge in this angle, so it's maybe a mind game. That's the stuff that's fascinating to me, because again, it's inferring more than just the game. So the problem with all this stuff is, in general, most people seem to just cynically follow what they think works and won't veer outside of that. And then also, you've got to, at least for other people, you've got to incentivize them in some way. I'm a bit weird in the sense that I really will just go down my own rabbit hole, whether it makes money or not. It's just a path I've taken. But I sadly had to learn myself. Other people seem to have different motivations.
Well, I think they get stuck in a paradigm. It's like, you know, with the veto thing, oh, we don't need to talk about vetoes, it's not important. And so then people spread it almost like a meme. Oh, we don't need to talk about vetoes, it's not important. I feel like with players, they're kind of, you know, maybe I don't know other games, but in Counter-Strike, it feels like they're stuck in this idea of like, I can just be this shy, you know, camera shy little boy who doesn't ever have to put himself out there. And I don't have to put my face out there. I don't have to be the brand. I mean, you are the brand, your face is the brand, but I don't have to build that brand. And then what happens when you get kicked off a team and now you're looking for the next team? Oh, gee whiz, half of you sit out for 6 months and you can't find a freaking team. Because nobody knows you. Nobody gives a shit about you. One example of the opposite of this that I thought was really interesting was when Smuya went on Richard Lewis's show. And, you know, for better or worse, whatever you want to say about Smuya, at least he freaking put himself out there. And I thought that was actually a decent interview. I thought he actually came across as relatively likable. And I'm surprised more players don't do that. They don't market themselves when they're sitting there going, oh, please, mommy and daddy, can I please have a team? Please, I'm poor and I can't get any money. Put yourself out there. Why aren't you doing interviews? Why aren't you grinding? I feel like a lot of players are stuck in this idea of like, I don't have to build a brand. I can just sit and wait for the TOs to come to me and give me money, or the teams to come to me and give me money. It's like, no.
I think at some degree you can parallel it to like Hollywood, though, like with actors. It's a reason why actors just go with the flow of like what is like the fucking like hive mind thought, because they're not supposed to think, they're not supposed to have opinions. They're getting chosen to some degree, unless you are a like top tier caliber player, like the top 10 to 20 in the world. Like you have to conform to some degree and you have to make sacrifices to like get onto those teams or put yourself into those positions unless you have that God-given talent. So I think some players might, because they're young or inexperienced, they don't want to like, it's about risk assessment to some degree. And I don't know how true this is. This is pure speculation, but that's something that came to mind for me, why maybe some of these players wouldn't want to do that kind of overexposure, because you never know what is going to be the thing that actually sticks and earns you favor in this fucked up social media culture, or if there's going to be something that you say that's going to get villainized and put you on the chopping block.
Sure.
I
was going to say, then fine, do it where you have full control on over the narrative. So go on HLTV, or even if that's too risky, stream or post on your Twitter, or do something where you have full control. And like Carrigan does really, really, really good videos on his YouTube channel where, yeah, it's like voice comms and all that kind of stuff. But that's him saying, look, here's my brain. I'm pretty freaking good. So I feel like
just like Thorne was saying, there's only one Thorne. There's only one Carrigan. There's only so many people that could be in that position.
No, I know what he means, though. He just means, like, you know, at least put in some effort, like try, basically. I suppose, give it a go.
Yeah,
the problem is this. Basically, this is another example. By the way, this is what nearly all these convos and all talk shows are about. They're always just going to be abstract convos that are interesting and hypotheticals. The reality is always so much more mundane and boring. So here's the reality of pro players. The 99.99% of pro players in all esports games think they get paid based on how good they are and that they are earning their employer thousands and thousands and millions of dollars. And you're thinking, I'm meaning just random. I'm talking like, I think Nico thinks that. I think Nico genuinely thinks he gets paid those tens of thousands of dollars a month because he's so fucking sick at Counter-Strike. He doesn't get, by the way, that if I just take him back in a time machine 15 years, he makes $500 a month. No matter how good he is. He can't, to him, sadly, part of this is actually a bigger principle of capitalism, essentially, which is everyone, because of how crony capitalism runs the world, assumes that they are, essentially, the joke is, it is what the communists say. They all think that they're the model of, like, the fucking factory worker in Victorian times. And then the guy at the top, in this case, it'd be Riot or ESL, this is just the prick who's, like, the industrialist making all the millions, and you're just the guy working for a pittance and gruel on his machines, and then he makes all the money from selling the gear, whatever it could be, wool or fucking steel, whatever it is in this case. They think that's the model they think they're in. It's why I made so much fun of pro players with Flashpoint, because it was the other way around. Like, Cloud9 are just pissing money away to these cunts, and the idiot players going like, I am being screwed by my... It's like, well, who's screwing who? Logically, you're exploiting him. I mean, not entirely, because he's allowing himself to be, obviously. And there's the whole thing of, yes, he is playing for a future benefit in the down the line with the VC, etc. But basically, pros don't get that at all. It's why that story about Config, where he didn't get to join Astralis, where what happened was, he was the most slam dunk player ever, by the way. Think about it. He was going to replace Kirby. He's just a better version of Kirby. Like, that would have been a sick Astralis lineup. And they wanted him. He was the first choice. But the reason why they didn't take him was he stupidly in the interview told Zonic, I don't want to do any media, I just here to frag bro. Well, spoiler, that era's gone 10 years before that, you idiot. Like, you have to do media, you have to be famous. Like, as you're saying, what if you don't even win in the game? Now why would anyone care about you? You have to know that. And so people like Config isn't alone in that, by the way. He was just stupid enough to verbalize it. Tons of pros think this. This is why, by the way, that entire battle happened between MIBR's players, people like Fur and the Org. Even though I've told this story before, here's the reality of what happened when Fur and them were in MIBR their last year or so. MIBR had structured their contract, so they already had one of the best salaries in the world, because when they originally signed them from SK, they were the number one team, if you remember, or they were close to number one. If you don't know, it's because they'd already agreed to that deal like months and months before they dropped off, and sadly, they dropped off right at the time they joined MIBR. But anyway, because they signed them, as you'd expect, to a very competitive, one of the best salaries in the world, they also then, on top of the base salary, structured it so that if you did well at like majors or you won tournaments, you got extra salary, you got more money than just the prize money, right? These twats, even though MIBR the org, to be nice to them, this is very rare, I've ever heard of an org doing this, but some of them, the Cloud9s of the world, have done it before. They just decided, you know what? They didn't reach any of those competitive bonuses, but you know what? Fuck it. They've done a good job promoting our brand. Give them the bonus anyway. And I heard, mate, they were getting like $20,000 or $30,000 bonuses on their yearly check. Just someone giving you $30,000. And these fucking twats in that MIBR team took that as a sign that they actually were having that money stolen from them. And then they heard other players in teams like maybe Na'Vi or something like that they were making even more salary. And so they started going to their org and the public and going, we are being stolen from and ripped off and exploited by MIBR. And the joke is, if you know where this goes, when they all left, spoiler, they don't make it. I mean, Fallen and Firmic, very good money in Imperial, but the people who are like, oh, no plano, and the ones who left to other teams, they make fuck all compared to what they made then. Like, that was an amazing situation, but these guys didn't get it. And so the problem is, if you think the only thing that determines your salary is how good you are at the game, yeah, you're never going to put any thought into these other things. Whereas actually, I would say to CSGO players, look at the example of League of Legends. I actually think League of Legends is the best example ever, because it's actually the game where it even became a famous meme in the community that motherfuckers like Skara and Voyboy probably only get to hang around because they've got all the social media following, because they've got a million Twitter followers, because they've got a massive Twitch they've built up, because they have all that shit. Like, that was at one point in time in the middle period in League, of where the cynical orgs used to pick you up. They used to look at those factors. And if you were 10 times better than the guy, but you had no social media, good luck getting in the team, because the only thing that can get you in the team is being sick at Lee Sin or whatever it is, you know. So I essentially, this is a bigger problem the whole industry faces, mate. And I actually think there's still an enormous paradigm shift has to happen to the CSGO pros particularly, because unfortunately they've just been insulated in a way that just hasn't happened in the other games. The other games seem to all get it now.
Yeah, basically they're not told, like, think of this as your brand, or think of this as like a chance to build a business. Like, yeah, you're playing Counter-Strike, you're playing a video game, but like, you could be building a business that'll last you for the rest of your life. Like, build a brand and parlay that after you finish, like, keep streaming or keep doing whatever you've done. But I think they just don't think of that, or nobody's telling them that. They don't.
I mean, Fallen, by the way, has probably done the best job with this. You know, he has literally set up like an empire for himself. It's crazy, dude. He's in the because he did stuff like sell that like gaming club, and stuff. He's also made loads and loads of money along the way. Still makes an insane salary to this day. And anytime he quits, you can imagine he'll just walk into a million job spots. I mean, remember he had the fucking president of Brazil calling him up. Like, this guy has killed it in that regard. Like, and people might not realize that part. That's one of the things I actually don't like about him. It's like, he's pretending he's putting all the hours in the fucking server, isn't he? So, but he's actually done an amazing... Essentially, the joke is he's actually gone too far the opposite way. It seems to me like he's overly obsessed with just the money in the career and the empire, and he doesn't put enough practice into the game, as it were.
I can't remember...
Is it the dishonesty you don't like?
I mean, I consider you defrauding your employer.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And also, this is where I'm very different. I will say, I should put this out there, because I'm sure people in this call might even be like this. I'm a really weird guy. As in, if you came to me and you said, right, I've got a website, it's going to be called Opcomma 2.0, I've got $5 million and I want to pay you $1 million to work there. Do you know what my answer would be? You're going to lose all that $5 million. I'm not worth $1 million, and that would be bad faith for me to say I can accept your deal. Now, I don't know that anyone else would do that, but I'm a weird guy.
So yeah,
I promise, like, players aren't going to do that, like, to be real. But at the same time, I think he's gone too far the other way. That's like me going, well, actually, I'd need $2 million because I'm really good. You know what I mean? Like, that's the Fallen equivalent. So I can't fuck with that at all.
I feel like there's a problem, too, where you would think potentially that the orgs would be incentivized to kind of build that infrastructure out for their players, right? Like, hook them up with streaming setups or, like, encourage that kind of thing. But the problem seems to be in both like CSGO and League of Legends, and honestly, just sports in general, that like the ability to rely on a player actually continuing to be on your team seems more and more tenuous, right? Like, it just seems like, what's the point of, like, let's say, Bill, you know, obviously this is a weird example because Bjergsen was on TSM for so long, but like in the modern day, like, what would be the point of building up Bjergsen's brand if next year he goes to EG and now you're TL and you've sunk all this money into that and whatnot?
Yeah, that is actually part of the mentality in a way. By the way, in general, in esports, the biggest problem is short-term thinking always short circuits longer-term thinking. People will always choose to win this next LCS BO1 over Win Worlds. They will always choose that. In fact, they don't even know that they're even sort of distinct things. They really think one leads to the other. They think it's like linear. They think if you win every BO1, eventually you just win Worlds. It's like, that's not really at all how competition works, you know. In fact, I'd even say, if you ever want to see the maddest example ever, this is probably a thing a lot of people don't know, I think. You know, in tennis, the players who were like, have all the Grand Slams and they were all battling each other in the race to be the greatest ever. The joke is, beyond the ones who were having insane years, some of them even almost started phoning it in at all the like ATP Masters 1000 tournaments, and they don't win those anymore. They just go for the Grand Slam. They're doing, because I mean, they're also super old. They're just doing everything peak at that one weekend where you win the Grand Slam. They're not even trying to be the best every day. They've got the whole philosophy down as to how you do it. By the way, I actually have an example of the real world to show you, though, that that CSGO problem is not going to be fixed tomorrow. So even though this is going to be slightly political, you'll know exactly what I mean as soon as I give the example. So I looked it up now because it's a recent story. It was only from this year. It was like a week ago or something. Right? So there was a movie. I didn't watch it. It was one of the Jurassic Park sequels. It was called Jurassic World 2. And it had the stars were Chris Pratt and then this woman called Bryce Dallas Howard, who was actually in that, like, Lars von Trier movie, if people ever saw it. That's how fucking bad my references are, but whatever. I don't know any of the fucking Zuma movies, so I haven't seen her anything else, mate. So anyway, what she complained about publicly was she said that essentially it must be discrimination because she was paid $8 million, but Chris Pratt was paid $10 million. Now, I'm sure any man who's ever thought about this knows that, like, it's not like they really did go, right, Chris, you have a dick, right? And he was like, yeah. Right, 10 million for him. Oh, Bryce, nah, yeah, only 8 million for you.
2 million for the balls.
Like, obviously, like, anyone can even see, I mean, it takes, like, 5 seconds to think this up. There'll obviously be movies where I'm going to guess, like, I mean, I'll think of a random example. Like, I'm going to guess Bryce Dallas Howard herself makes way more than a fucking other man on the movie. I'm sure there's some fucking side character that makes way less than $1 million. But she never thinks of that because she's just framing it in one way. Like, what she's basically saying there is she thinks that Hollywood is a planned Soviet economy and they just arbitrarily decide how much money they allocate you and that they really are looking at her and going, as a woman, you're inferior, so here's $8 million. Now, obviously, by the way, the other reason that story in a sane world would never go over well is it is a story of woman who luckily gets to pretend to play shit characters complains $8 million isn't enough. You know, like, that angle shouldn't sell with anyone, but I get how they frame it. But basically, she also doesn't understand any of the mechanisms or metrics that determine her career. Spoiler, by the way, I actually suspect she cynically does know all that. She's just said it to get the PR boost and hope she gets paid more money. That would be my guess.
Yeah, of course.
In fact, there's even an angle there where her agent might tell her, the way we give the studio winners, they just say on the next movie they paid you both the same. You can even have that shit tied in, you know, but you get the bigger principle. I get the sense a lot of people in life are like this. It's why, actually, I think most criticism of capitalism doesn't work. It's not that they're not right. There's fucking tons of problems with capitalism, and I don't actually know that we've ever run actual capitalism. It just seems to be cronyism, cartelism. But the main problem is most people never actually take a moment to learn the dynamics. They don't learn the mechanisms. They just hear, like, it's bad. And then they don't try to figure out, well, what was at play here? How did this work? Like, for example, this happened. This is why I do that show with Lerpus, if you know. We just do it to set things straight. That one with the know-it-alls of CS. Because people don't even know how, like, markets are set, for example. So you know that famous example they give, where if I say to you, so in League of Legends, you guys will all know it was originally Immortals with Noah Winston who came in, and they didn't just inflate the market. They did it in, like, a really irresponsible way. Like, they would come in and just go, I'll pay you twice as much. That's not even how you fucking do a market. Like, a market's like, right, you make, like, one times what you make now, I'll give you 1.2. These cunts just came in like, oh, two times. And in doing so, right, this is what the fan never gets. They think, well, everyone else could just wait till Immortals pays, and then they can just pay the same. That isn't how a market works. As soon as Immortals sets the price, the other players are going to ask for that. And you know what? Someone else is going to give them it. And then the second person that gives them it, we're all fucked now, because then the third person is going to give you slightly less than him, but more than otherwise. And eventually, even the best guy in business, he either will have to be the god of min-maxing, like companies like Ensign Gambit, or he's going to himself get drawn along with them, and his fucking inflation is going to go up just like the rest in terms of the salaries. And so if you don't understand that dynamic of how the first and the biggest buyer sets the price, you're actually in a terrible position if you try to talk about, like, things like judgments. Like, well, that's just silly. I wouldn't pay that person. I don't think he's worth that. It's like, those discussions sound great in an abstract, but they become actually meaningless once you know the mechanisms. So that's a bigger problem, I think, with industry topics is, like I've alluded to even on the streaming one, in some ways, not only do very few people understand the mechanisms, but they're also almost intentionally obscured so that in the short term, people who do know those mechanisms can use them to have leverage over you, to control you, to profit from you. Spoiler, that is also how society works.
Right. And that kind of ties into, like, the incentives. It's like the players' incentives are, like, not exactly the same as the orgs. Like, with, I was listening to the most recent return by the numbers, and you were discussing the Astralis cell and the LEC, which is like, it's like, okay, so was the plan actually just to get the buy-in at buy low, sell high? Like allegedly he's doing currently, or was there an actual, like, incentive to, like, build this org up to, like, a G2 where it's like, you're going to invest in these players, you're going to develop this thing. Cause it, you know, from the outside, it looks like the incentives were set to okay, I'm buying in at this.
Yeah, make the best team you can at all times, right? Yeah. Okay.
So it's like, yeah. But then the player's incentive, you know, if they get that contract to Astralis, it's like they're not thinking, right, I'm just a pawn in this organization's dream. I'm not actually going to be trying to get to the like top or whatever, right? So it's like the player is always going to be like, I'm going to try my best to do the best, where it's like the org behind the scenes could be like, yeah, no, you're not, buddy. Like, you're here for the ride. Like,
oh, I agree.
I think the exact opposite can happen, though, too, where it's like, obviously, you know, the check stealer stuff that happens with a ton of esports players, where it's like, they get paid regardless of performance, because it's not like the old West days of, you know, CSGO or whatever, where you just, you made your living off of your tournament earnings as opposed to your salary. And so I don't
know. By the way, have you ever noticed how I'm one of the only people who essentially fights for that? Because that was what League of Legends hijacked, dude.
Yeah.
In League of Legends, because you got the base salary and even winning Worlds, like only one person gets to win Worlds, and it's just, even though it's not the TI money, I think genuinely that created the part of this world where it's just about winning LCS, etc. Like, because you actively disincentivize people. If it was TI, in Dota 2, you have to just try and be the best team. That's all everyone's trying to do, because you just want to win the big prize payout at the end of the year. It's fucked up in some ways, but essentially what I'm saying is just appeal to people's cynical nature. That's the best I can do.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that it's like, obviously you can see, when thinking about like old TSM, right, when TSM was the most successful team in NA, I think a huge part of that success, independent of like getting lucky with Bjergsen and getting Bat locked in or whatever, was just that they could sell their players not only on like, hey, come to TSM, we're a good team or a top of the pack team, but they were like, come to TSM, you will have 24,000 viewers minimum every time you stream, and you'll make so much money from that on top of it. And just like, I feel like those kind of incentives have like slowly disappeared from the scene, where you know, if you look at the biggest league streamers now, I don't know that other than like Bjergsen, any of them are really current players, right? Like Doublelift probably outdoes every single person in the LCS who's not Bjergsen. And similarly, if you looked at like LEC or whatever, it's like, it seems like the old names now have control of that. Like Dom probably, I wouldn't even say probably, almost certainly is outstreaming in terms of that kind of income every player in the LEC who's not one of the old guard. And so now it's just like, well, you get your salary regardless of what happens. And especially if you're like from a region like NA, where there's basically zero chance of you winning Worlds, what is there to aspire to other than like, you know, not getting kicked off your team, essentially?
Yeah, I agree with you. I just wanted to add too, I think the thing to tie in was that early on when TSM was dominant, when a new player, like when Wild Turtle joined TSM, it's like he was immediately tossed into the content. He was immediately in the VODs, like of like the documentary series
reality they were series, doing. Yeah,
he was streaming. And like, if you watch that stuff, he started off kind of shy and not like he developed himself as like he developed his personality as like he was exposed more. And so when he finally did like leave TSM, it's like he was Wild Turtle the player. He just wasn't a TSM Wild Turtle, like the player fill in doing his job. So yeah, I just wanted to add that point too, because I think the culture of the team was also a big motivator for people to want to be in that, besides the like clout of being like, or not the clout, rather the skill and the caliber at the time.
This video was kindly supported by Kill Your Inner Loser, Ahmed Haju, Matt Pugnaccio Rakula, Paul Villa, Travis Goff, Adam Ux, Animosity, Bot Pounder 420, Hades, Jensen Gore, Kovacevic, Piercy, Tobias Bernasconi, Tosh, Toucan, and as always, special thanks goes out to Jerky's Minion. Do you want to suggest a topic or a guest for my shows? Would you like to ask a question in my Patreon AMA? Maybe you want teasers, find out who the next Reflections guests are or upcoming talk show guests. Do you want to take part in one of those long donator discussions with me? Well, if any of the above or more sound interesting to you, put your money where your mouth is. Join the Skrilluminati today via the Patreon link in the description box below.